Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient.
Alright, alright, alright. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. It's Monday morning here till 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Yeah, it's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. My dad tells a joke every Monday morning. We also have the movie reviews, the Monday morning movie reviews with Jim Laskowski and Eric Childress. We've got those to talk about, and then Eric's going to stick around. We always do a box office report, tell you what movies made the most money over the weekend. So that's all coming up. Yeah, and much more. 312-981-7200 is the phone number, and we're going to be talking about the worst Saturday Night Live hosts of all time. We have some weird food combinations that shouldn't exist, and we'll talk a little bit about Jackie Chan, too. He's 65 now, and which is really amazing, and he's still doing it. He's still kicking and running around and jumping up and doing crazy stunts and all that cool stuff. He's so great, such an icon. So and much more. As always, our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on Facebook, facebook.com/Nick D Show. And it is a Monday morning. Let me say hello to my producer. That's Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick.
How are you, man?
I'm doing good. Getting a little bit of a cold here, but I think it's just the changing of the weather.
Yeah, well, all right. Well, take care of yourself, man.
Trying to.
All right. So what'd you do? How, did you have a good weekend?
Yeah, went back home, saw the folks, cleaned out some stuff from my old home.
Yeah.
Because they're moving on to Colorado.
Yeah.
And they need to get all my stuff out of there.
Okay. So that was it was a productive weekend then.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay. All right. Well, cool. All right. And in the newsroom, we have Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Good morning, sir.
How are you, man?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
I got a lot of fresh air over the weekend. You know how that kind of makes you feel a little bit tired? I think it's just from being so relaxed from all that fresh air.
Yeah.
I think I'm having a little bit of that.
Is that what's going on?
Yeah.
Now? All right. So
yeah, we were outside a lot this weekend.
I got a tired guy and a sick guy. working with me tonight.
Big laughs tonight.
You know what? You know what I checked out on Saturday? You ever been to the blind barber? I mean, maybe in probably not actually, because you're not going to bars anymore. But I went to this place in Fulton Market District over the weekend, and it was pretty cool. It's one of those speakeasy places, barber shop during the day in the front, and then at night you walk through the barber shop and you go to the back, which is a bar.
Wow. Okay.
Pretty cool.
Oh, no. Okay, that sounds pretty cool. Also, you happen to live with a Milwaukee Brewers fan, so.
And you know what? The night that I did that was Saturday night, which was when the Cubs won.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, her and I watched the other two games together.
Sure. Yeah. She had a fine weekend.
You know who's worse is her brother. He's the one in Milwaukee. Or I'm sorry, Racine. He's the one who texts.
Oh, wait,
and,
oh, really?
Talks trash. Yeah.
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 Well, you know, a home opener today.
Yeah.
Wrigley home opener. Looks like they're going to have pretty good weather today for the home opener. I've been out there in at Wrigley Field, you know, when it's been like 20 degrees. It's been like 20 degrees out for the home opener, man.
Yeah, they'll have it nice today.
It'll be relatively nice weather for the opener, playing the Pirates today. So at home. All right. Well, we got baseball season is underway, so there you go. We got all the movie reviews coming up in a little bit. Did you happen to watch Saturday Night Live over the weekend at all? that.
I had to. I felt like skipping it because something about Kit Harington does not scream great host to me.
He was not a great host. You know, and as I was saying to Carl and Lisa, writing staff didn't do him any favors either, because it wasn't a particularly funny show. Yeah, he wasn't. He just wasn't very. He wasn't very good. And they did the, you know, the opening. You know how they do the when the host comes out, obviously does the monologue at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
It's always it always rings of desperation whenever they do the Q&A with the audience. You know how they do that?
Yeah.
It's like the writers were like, whatever, man, let's just do the Q&A thing. We can't really write anything. So they had like a whole bunch of cast members from Game of Thrones,
mm-hmm.
you know, make cameos at the beginning to ask questions,
okay,
you know?
Yeah.
So that was what they did. And it was not particularly
I feel
strong.
Like the whole show's kind of been in a slump for a while.
It's been a pretty not a great season. I can tell you that right now. But Sarah Bareilles was fantastic.
Oh yeah, I mean she's an amazing musician,
unbelievable, man.
Yeah.
And she was the without question the best part of the show. She's just amazing. So she was by far the best part of the show. I don't know if. You know, if Michael Che and Colin Jost were your head writers on the show, I don't know if they were distracted because of the whole WrestleMania thing, because they appeared on WrestleMania last night.
That's true.
And they've been doing promos, you know, on WWE, on Raw, and on SmackDown and stuff like that now. And so I don't know if that was what distracted them.
Their mind was on the ring.
Yeah, I don't know. But anyway. And, you know, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, there just wasn't enough, you know, for me every week. There's not enough Heidi Gardner. I need more Heidi Gardner. I think every episode of SNL needs her, like in every sketch.
Yeah, let her shine.
I mean, she's just, I love her, and that you know, I think she's solid all the way around. She's really really funny all the way around. And again, that sketch or that character that she does, the angel. Every boxer's girlfriend for every boxer's girlfriend from every boxing movie ever made. It's just one of the funny. I'm taking my kids to my sister's. Still one of the funniest things of all time. So, okay, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna break, and we got to take a break here. When we come back, it'll be time for the movie reviews with Jim and Eric. All the new movies. We'll talk about that, and we'll also talk about the box office. Thanks everybody for listening. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. We'll break here. When we come back, it's movie review time. Home crowd at the UC? Check. Eastern Conference rival? Check. A chance to knock the Knicks down a peg? You bet. Bulls Knicks, Tuesday at 7 on WGN TV. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It is a Monday morning, and that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time, as we do every Monday morning. And we've got a bunch of other stuff we're going to be talking about. We're going to talk about hosting Saturday Night Live, the worst SNL hosts of all time. It was a pretty terrible show this past Saturday with Kit Harington, and we're going to talk about some of that. And Adam Sandler has been announced as one of the hosts, and so we're going to talk about that and much more. Food combinations that shouldn't exist. It's also Jackie Chan's 65th birthday, if you can believe that, and I'm sure he's celebrating by like jumping off of a building or something. But it is Monday, and that means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski join me to talk about the new movies, and we talk about the box office as well. So we'll get into that here as we do on every Monday morning. So 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. You can also follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. So let's welcome the guys to the show. Here's Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Jim. Welcome back, Jim.
Hello there.
Yes. Jim, you actually had a you did an interview for your podcast this past week, right?
Yeah. So one of my favorite actresses working today is actually in a movie we're going to review later on, and I had the immense pleasure of talking with her on Voices and Visions for a good 20 minutes about, you know, horror and her history and what it's like being cast in Pet Sematary. Her name is Amy Simetz, and if you look at her credits, they're quite impressive. She's directed episodes of Atlanta, co-created the TV show adaptation of The Girlfriend Experience. And for me personally, she gave one of the all-time great performances in the movie that I absolutely adore called Upstream Color. So to talk with her is kind of an honor for me. So it was a blast to interview her, and people can check that out currently over at voicesvisions.net.
All right, there you go. And we'll be reviewing Pet Sematary in just a little bit. So there you go. All right, you guys. Let's am I the only one that's like insanely excited for Fosse Verdon? I'm losing my mind.
No. I'm excited.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
I don't even know what to say, man.
The movie could be called Jack and Jill as long as you tell me Sam Rockwell and Michelle Williams are in it.
Yeah,
I'm there.
It's just ridiculous. It's gonna be. I hope it's good.
Oh yeah.
I really hope it's good. So anyway, I'm sorry. I clicked onto the IMDb and that was the first ad that it was the first ad that popped up, and I saw it and I was like, oh yeah, that's right. It premieres tomorrow. So
yes.
All right. Well, let's start here. Jim, why don't you tell us about Ash is the Purest White?
Okay, well, yeah, this is a really interesting film from a fascinating Chinese filmmaker named Jiang Zhangke. Hopefully I pronounced that right. And this time he's decided to explore the mafia underground starting in the early 2000s. And it's basically covering what a life in crime does to a particular relationship between very complex people. The woman here, her name is Chiao, and she sports a very Mia Wallace haircut in the beginning, similar to her character in one of this director's other films called Unknown Pleasures. We first meet her at a nightclub in Datong circa 2001, and she's very devoted to this heavy mafia guy named Bin, who has ambitions of becoming a kingpin, of course. He wants to rise in the world of crime. Chiao and Bin are very close to the point where they can finish each other's sentences and share cigarettes, and they're able to de-escalate most eruptions of tension among the bad guys circulating the group. So she's really good at keeping the peace, all while making sure her activist father doesn't get into trouble. Until one evening, a really intense fight breaks out in the streets, and Bin tries to take on an entire gang using only his fists. Eventually, he's becoming bruised and bullied and pummeled, so Chiao actually takes out his gun, gets out of the car, and fires it into the air. And while simply firing or just possessing a gun is forbidden in that country, and instead of informing the police that the gun wasn't hers, she ends up taking the fall and serves 5 years in prison. We then cut to years later where we follow her on this quest to find Bin, which, you know, initially this is someone she thought she was the love of her life. But he has since disappeared after she went to jail for him. So the rest of this film is more of a meditation, kind of while we sort of follow this lead character. And it's really, really kind of an enveloping film because we're also really exposed to, like, just how much, you know, the world of China is changing even just in a span of a few years. You know, so that's pretty much the gist of it. The filmmaker really is an interesting one, and he's the type who assumes that you can sort of fill in the blanks and kind of concentrates on the more intimate moments, kind of reminding me of like Wong Kar Wai mixed with Antonioni, especially with the pacing at times. It starts off really energetic. There's this really cool extended use of the song YMCA that puts it in a really joyful context, but it's later contrasted, and I think that, you know, you think of a like mafia movie, you kind of go, oh, well, you know what to expect. And in the beginning, it's like, oh, this is kind of like a flashy Scorsese movie. But then it pulls the rug out from, out from under you. And it becomes a more thoughtful film, a much more differently paced film about, 40 minutes in or so, because you're really just sort of on board with this woman as she's, sort of trying to figure out her path in life and also try to reconnect not only with her long-lost love, but also just the world of China as it's changing. And I think that's really what this filmmaker is really interested in, not only just like the intimate storytelling and character studies, but just how culture changes and how time passes. Some people are saying this is one of the best films by this director. It does touch on familiar themes and feelings that he's captured in other films like Still Life, which probably is my favorite of his. And it's, not unlike something like, in terms of the pacing, like his last film, Mountains May Depart. I think for people who are familiar with this director's work, they'll definitely check this out regardless. And I'm definitely recommending it because, like I said, I was really, I wound up very involved with the story. So if you want a unique take on the Chinese mafia, but mainly focused on a woman and her journey to reconnect, I think you'll be very happy that you invested the time. It's well worth a look, and I believe it's playing at the Landmark Century and the Arclight.
Yeah, it's playing at River East as well. So there's three places
Great.
You can check it out. All right, well, there you go. All right, let's move on. Eric, why don't you tell us about Shazam?
Okay, well, this is the latest effort from the DC side of the aisle as far as all the comic book versions, adaptations that we've been getting lately. Many people might, some people from my generation might remember the live-action television version of Shazam back in the day. But this one is much more polished, and it stars Asher Angel plays a young man named Billy Batson. He was sort of orphaned at a young age. He lost his mother at a carnival. He's kind of been living around the foster scene for several years, despite trying to locate whatever happened to his mother. He ends up in a new foster home that is sort of privy to taking in a lot of foster children. So he has a number of new brothers and sisters. One of them is sort of played by Jack Dylan Glazer, sort of kind of obsessed with superheroes and all all the baggage that comes with them, their powers, their weaknesses, and all that kind of stuff. And one day, while riding the subway train, Billy is actually transported off to a wizard's lair, where played by Jaimin Hunsu, and he is looking to pass along his powers so that they just, the force of evil can be kept at bay, and it can be given to someone who is pure at heart and is not going to be tempted by the bad forces that have surrounded the wizard in his lair for much of his time. So he ends up choosing Billy. And whenever he says the magical word Shazam, which is actually an anagram of many of the sort of the powerful figures of Greek mythology, he is transformed into a superhero, a older superhero, so sort of shades of Big applied to the film. And he goes about testing his superhuman powers and, while not exactly sure what might be in store for him. But there's also another person played by Mark Strong, who in the prologue many years ago was actually offered the wizard's powers, but he was a little more attuned to the temptations of the monsters that are personified by the seven deadly sins, and he was not chosen and spent his entire life trying to track down these powers. Okay. So, all right, confrontation.
Hang on. Eric, hang on, okay?
Okay.
We got to take a break. Okay, guys, hold on. Eric and Jim are here. We're going to take a break for the news. When we come back, we'll hear more about Shazam from Eric. And we got other movies to review, as well as check out the box office, too, right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about the worst SNL hosts of all time and food combinations that shouldn't exist. And it's Jackie Chan's birthday. He's 65 today, so we're going to talk about some of his best movies. Speaking of movies, it is Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Jim Laskowski, Eric Childress join me every Monday morning to review the new movies. Before the break, Eric was telling us about Shazam. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Hello.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you again.
All right. Eric, continue with your talking about Shazam here.
So these two superpowers, super good and super villain, are headed for eventual confrontation. I forgot to mention that when transformed into the older superhero, it is personified by Zachary Levi, formerly of the television show Chuck, is probably what he's most known for. He also did the voice of one of the characters in the Disney film Tangled. But, you know, so get into, you know, the DC Marvel wars, as they sometimes get to. Marvel has, you know, sort of outpaced DC 2-1 in their output, and DC has, for, you know, many of their films, sort of because of the Zack Snyder stuff, have kind of leaned on the sort of the dark, less fun stories of their, you know, very famous characters. Wonder Woman was sort of a breakthrough for them with audiences. Many critics liked that one, and audiences clearly liked Aquaman, or at least they went to see it, even though that wasn't very good. But I was thoroughly charmed by this movie. I didn't know what to expect from it. I thought that really had potential because of the tone that the film was setting for itself. I was a big fan of the television show Chuck when it was on, and have liked Zachary Levi in the past, and he's really good in this movie. He's really good, as just about everybody is in this movie. I think Mark Strong makes a terrific villain in this thing, and it's a film that, well, you know, it has some scary stuff in there. The tone is decidedly light, and it's the kind of tone that, you know, one of those rare occasions that actually sort of took me back to the types of movies that I really loved growing up. I mean, when I was a really young kid, I would have really loved this movie when I was a kid. And I had a lot of that sort of flowing through me while watching this thing. You know, I really cared about what was going to happen to these characters. I really liked the real extended third act of this movie, the confrontation between Zachary Levi and Mark Strong. It has a really, you know, I mentioned Big earlier. It actually has a real nice shout out to Big in the film that I thought was really cute and clever. There's so much about this movie that I really enjoyed. I laughed a lot. I laughed very hard during this movie. I really love the final moment of the movie. I thought that was hilarious. There was a moment during this movie where, during the climax, which I won't reveal too much what happens there, but I got up a charge. I kind of almost went yes in the theater watching this thing, and I didn't even get to say through the end credits for it, but I'm really looking forward to seeing this one again. I think this is a real great turning point for the DC universe, particularly because I think it's about the first good movie I think they've made, frankly.
Oh, okay. All right, I didn't get a chance. I didn't get a chance to see that. It did. It did pretty well over the weekend, though.
Oh, it did quite well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, there you go. So Shazam gets a good review from Eric. All right, Jim, tell us about The Public.
All right. Well, this is the latest independent film from Emilio Estevez, who you probably remember from The Breakfast Club. Of course, he's also a writer and director. He's made films like Wisdom and Men at Work. I was a little curious, and we'll get to reasons why in a bit here. But this takes place in Cincinnati, Ohio, and it begins with this PSA about what it's like to pursue a career as a librarian. You know, and of course, during this PSA, they say, you know, it requires a love of both books and people. The subtext, you know, here, as we begin the story, of course, focuses mainly on the homeless community, because obviously they are people, too. And the story starts on a scene of a group of street dwellers waiting for the public library to open. And it's mainly due to the fact that it's winter and freezing cold outside. The library is essentially a warm refuge for those who have nowhere else to go. Emilio Estevez plays Stuart, kind of a, you know, low-key, meek librarian who, you know, credits books with saving his life at a time when he was suffering with addiction. So he definitely loves books, and he's surrounded by them, but he's also very fond of people. He knows all the patrons' names, talks to all the regulars, and, you know, and tries to do his best in a very low-key job for the most part. He's also helped by Myra, played by Jenna Malone, who is kind of this idealistic activist of sorts in addition to being a librarian, and who in her first conversation with Stuart begins to chastise him for not taking public transportation or doing more good in the world to stay green. So after that, after we're introduced to our main characters, we get introduced to a couple of subplots involving Christian Slater as a mayoral candidate and Alec Baldwin as a hostage negotiator. We sort of learn a little bit about their personal lives. And then all these players are sort of set into motion one night when all of the homeless patrons decide to stage a protest of sorts. Since it is bitterly cold outside, they demand that they be allowed to use the library as a temporary shelter, since all the other shelters in the city are full, and they just want a place to keep warm. And, of course, this eventually involves security and then the police and Alec Baldwin as a hostage negotiator, even though none of these patrons, of course, are doing anything violent or don't carry a weapon of any kind. They just want to stay in the library to stay warm. And, of course, Stuart is caught in the middle between, you know, wanting to keep his job, but also his desire to help and assist the homeless community during this difficult winter. So that's basically the plot. And, you know, first things first, the main reason why I wanted to see this film is because I currently work in a public library. And, you know, not too long ago, I was asked by a patron, you know, exactly why libraries have become kind of a sanctuary for the homeless population. And there are a lot of think pieces that date back to a 2007 article that Estevez read, which inspired him to sort of tell this particular story. So I know he has his heart in the right place, kind of like he did when he made another ensemble piece like Bobby. But really, the execution here is far too heavy-handed and preached right from the mouths of the characters to where none of them seem like fully realized human beings, and that's really a shame. I think the only one who comes across as genuine is the great Michael K. Williams, who is kind of the main organizer of this library protest, and he's probably the most rounded figure. But then again, his story is kind of sidelined by focusing on, you know, the non-homeless protagonist played by Estevez. It becomes a little bit of a vanity piece to some degree when it's focusing, you know, on the librarian as opposed to the homeless community as a whole at times. And also, he introduces, like, Christian Slater, you know, in his struggles as a politician, and Alec Baldwin having a drug addicted son. So there's just like a little bit too much, too many cooks in the kitchen here, so to speak. And, you know, this is a really important issue. And I think, you know, even the way he decides to approach this material, he kind of underplays it, even for comedy in the final minutes, that I kind of thought was a little insulting, to be honest, even if he had good intentions by, you know, trying to find humor in these circumstances. But, you know, at the same time, if people see this movie and have an interesting conversation that, you know, revolves around something I personally experienced, then, you know, I think it's, you know, okay. But as a movie and as a script, it's pretty self-righteous and very ludicrous at times. I think he's fighting the good fight here, but I almost think that the subject matter would be better explored as a documentary. I really do. I think it would be interesting to sort of almost have like a mini-series or something about all the people who are suffering or struggling out there, especially when it's, you know, bitterly cold outside and they need a place to stay warm. So as much as I want to champion a movie that takes place in a library and does have something vital to say, I just can't recommend the public because it could have been done a whole lot better.
All right. All right. Well, there you go. All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Jim are going to hang on. That's the public, not recommended by Jim. We'll take a quick break. We're going to come back, and we're going to review the latest Stephen King adaptation, Pet Sematary, latest version of that. All right, and we'll do that right after the break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about the worst SNL hosts of all time. We got some food combinations that should not exist, and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, and you can talk or text us there, 312-981-7200. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski join me to review the new movies, and then Eric sticks around and we talk about the box office. Got one more movie to review this week. Let's welcome Eric. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jim, welcome back.
Thank you much.
Well, none of us got to see The Best of Enemies, which is the new Taraji P. Henson and Sam Rockwell movie. And I've only seen the trailers, and it looks kind of interesting. But it seems to me that Sam Rockwell's kind of playing the same role he played in Three Billboards.
It kind of looks that way,
but I don't know. I have not seen it.
Well, in fairness to his Three Billboards character, he wasn't in the KKK.
Well, that's true. He
in
wasn't.
Fairness.
He wasn't. He couldn't. He certainly qualified. Anyway.
Or did he? I think that's debatable.
Yeah, there you
but
go.
Anyway, so
we got that. That came out this week as well. But the latest horror movie here for the year of 2019 is another adaptation of Pet Sematary, the Stephen King novel. Eric, tell us about Pet Sematary.
Okay, well, I think most people are aware of what the plot of Pet Sematary is, whether you are a fan of Stephen King's book or even you're just familiar with the 1989 adaptation, big screen adaptation by Mary Lambert. People know this is the story of a family that moves into a new country home for their father's job, who's a physician at a local school, and they live next to a very dangerous road with a lot of semis. Are speeding through for some reason. They have a kindly old next door neighbor named Judd Crandall, and across the way there is a pet cemetery where all the local children go to place their deceased pets. But beyond the pet cemetery is an Indian burial ground where you put stuff in there, and well, they come back a little different. So, you know, people are familiar with the story. know that tragedy is going to befall this family in a number of ways. First, they lose their cat, and then things get even more sinister. So, you know, we don't need to spend too much time on the plot, because I want to spend more time on everything else about this version of Pet Sematary, which I actually found to be quite the travesty. And I'm saying that as someone who actually never got around to reading King's book, but I am very familiar with it, as I am the different interpretation from the 1989 version, although this one, directed by Kevin Kolsch and Dennis Vidmeyer, who directed a film a couple years ago called Starry Eyes that I felt was kind of a one-joke note type horror film, even though a lot of other people kind of praised it. They've taken their own liberties with the story, but that's not where my issues really lie with it. I'll get to those in a second. I was struck very early on with this version of just how, not just how bland it was, but just how kind of ineptly conceived and how rushed it seemed to feel. I mean, this is the story where, you know, we're in the sort of potential new Stephen King renaissance now, given that It was such a huge success, and a number of his old films that were adapted in the 70s and 80s are going to be remade, you know, shortly. It Chapter 2 is coming out later this year as well. So it seemed like, you know, everyone's sort of getting a second chance to sort of correct the errors of some of these old works. And, you know, the Mary Lambert's version was not particularly good. I think it was, at the time, I thought it was okay. Watching it recently again, a little bit less so, mainly because the acting is pretty terrible in it, aside from Fred Gwynn as the kindly neighbor, Judd Crandall. He's played in this version by John Lithgow, and I think that they kind of do him a big disservice, not just by, again, not including the character's wife in the film, which is also not in the 1989 version, but it just seems like his, even like one of his big monologues in the movie, they decide to cut away from John Lithgow and do a voiceover narration instead. That kind of reduces the impact of the narration that he's given. And, you know, like, you know, The Shining was a story about alcoholism that was famously kind of, you know, shuttered aside by Stanley Kubrick, but, you know, made his own very interesting version out of that story. But Pet Sematary has always been a story about grief and death and discussing it and the after effects and how grief and sorrow is something that just never leaves you. It's just, it just kind of grows in the same way that, like, revenge grows, and those seeds that are planted in you are just hard to get away from, and it helps to motivate these characters' behavior. And this film, while it sort of touches upon a few things that are in the novel that Mary Lambert's version kind of shuttered aside, again, it all feels like it's on speed dial at times. There's so many instances where it seems like they didn't read the book, but actually just saw the 1989 film version, and we're doing a book report off of that. This film actually manages to be shorter than Mary Lambert's version, yet it feels twice as fast and yet twice as slow. This is a movie that doesn't have a great sense of dread to it, which I thought was something that Lambert's version did have at the very least. I was not scared by this version. I think the changes they make to the story in the you know, at the end of the second act and through the third act do a disservice to the sort of sad creepiness of what King initially envisioned. And I got really angry at this film, first at the incompetence of it, and then that it sort of failed to deliver on everything that the movie is supposed to be about, and then ultimately it just not being very scary. I mean, so many of these scare scenes in this movie, I think all of them, sort of come down to what I was calling in the theater, look, there's another squirrel on the roof. It's just someone walks into a room, they hear something on the roof kind of pitter-patting around, and that's going to lead to the big scare scene, which is not particularly scary to be at all. I really kind of hated this movie, and I'm going to be, you know, stunned if this movie actually doesn't end up on my worst list at the end of the year. I was really shocked how much I disliked this movie.
Wow. All right. All right, Jim, go ahead.
Well, I will definitely say that I was quite disappointed as well. I don't know if I disliked it quite as much as Eric did, but at the same time, yeah, I would definitely concur that this is one of Stephen King's scariest books with kind of a jaw-dropping ending. And, you know, it's the kind of story that kept me up when I first read it and gave me nightmares. Probably because I'm a cat guy. I've always, you know, had cats in my house. But this latest version, you know, it's hard not to, like, give away kind of the two major changes, and I obviously won't. But, you know, the directions that the screenwriter decided to take, I don't know. I didn't buy it. I just didn't. And Eric's definitely right in the pacing. It felt off to me for most of the running time. It just didn't feel like it had a pulse. No pun intended. But it's just, you know, I wasn't a huge fan of Mary Lambert's take on this material, despite obviously thinking, you know, Fred Gwynn was pretty much perfect as Judd. And I definitely think Lithgow is a highlight here. But yeah, the way the story sort of plays out, I found to be kind of ridiculous. And Gage here is more of a, like, an afterthought, which, you know, I thought was a bummer. I know why that is. But what it comes down to too, is I just didn't find this version to be particularly scary. It felt muted and, off-key to some degree. I think there are really good scenes involving Rachel and her memories of taking care of her sister. Of course, I really, you know, loved Amy Simons, as I always expect to anyway. But I didn't really think Jason Clark, you know, I didn't think he was that strong here, and I just didn't get emotionally wrapped up. As you know, and this is a story about grief, like Eric said, and that's something that usually hits home for me in a lot of ways. I just felt this was a pale imitation of, you know, really great source material that I've yet to see done right on screen. And I do think that there is a little bit too much awareness from these filmmakers of the 1989 version that's buried in there, you know, especially once something occurs late in the film. I didn't think it was horrible because I liked a couple of performances, including Jatte Lawrence, who plays Ellie. And, you know, there's a couple of creepy flashbacks that I found effective. But overall, I just didn't get as scared as I'd hoped to be. And, you know, I love the book so much that maybe there's no way I'm going to enjoy a version of this story on the big screen. So I can't recommend this updating of Pet Sematary either.
All right, guys, hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll take a quick break. When we come back, I'll tell you what I thought of Pet Sematary right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on WGN, and we'll be right back. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios here on a Monday morning, here until 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. Got a lot of other stuff coming up here. Before the break, Eric and Jim both gave their reviews of Pet Sematary. They both disliked it. Eric really, really disliked it. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay. I am absolutely, completely on the opposite end of both of you guys. I thought this movie was great. I thought it was really scary. It's my favorite Stephen King book. I think it's the scariest thing he's ever written. I thought the Mary Lambert version sucked. I thought it was terrible. But I thought the changes that they made in this one were really cool. I liked what they did. And there's a couple of major changes, as you guys know, that they've made from not just the Mary Lambert version, but, you know, the book itself. Which, by the way, got, you know, got okays from Stephen King. He's a fan of this version. I thought it captured what was really deeply twisted about that book beautifully. I thought Jason Clarke was I thought everybody was terrific in this movie, especially the girl. The little girl is unbelievable in the movie. She's fantastic. Jete Lawrence. She's fantastic. I thought the changes, but I thought what the book is really about. You guys are talking about grief. You guys are talking about how people deal with death. I thought that was absolutely at the forefront of what this movie really is. And I think there's a real sense of dread throughout the movie. I think it's a really scary movie, like a really, really scary movie. And it got under my skin the way the book got under my skin. I really thought Jason Clarke did a really great quiet job, showing the desperation of what happens to this character and how he deals with, you know, the losses. I thought the cat was fantastic. I loved the cat. Lithgow does a great job here. And I thought the atmosphere was really cool. I thought it was really creepy. All of the stuff with Rachel and her sister is as effective as it was in the book, and not as cartoonish as it was in Mary Lambert's version. There was a real sense of terror in that. Every time that she would have like a nightmare or a flashback concerning her sister, I was hooked. And you know, there's some dumbwaiter stuff in here that I thought was really, really scary. I was on board 100% for this, and I actually thought it was really scary, and it definitely got under my skin big time. I was creeped out by it, and I think it's a really darkly twisted movie in the same way that the book was really darkly twisted and really, really just kind of a screwed up, just a very screwed up movie and a screwed up book. And I thought they captured it perfectly, and I think it's really scary, and I think it's really good, and I love the changes that they made to the story, and I'm on board 100% with this movie. I thought it was great. I actually thought it was really, really great. So, I don't know.
Wow.
Yeah.
I did not think you were going to like this movie, Nick. I was watching the movie, I was thinking of you, thinking of this tonight, and the thing that I thought was going to put you off was not so much the changes and that, but I just thought that the film is so flaky. It feels so off the entire movie, not in a good way. Because the stuff with the sister I thought was so forced into the film. Like, they kept going like, oh shoot, we forgot to put that in. Let's put that back in. Get that back in. That's how that kind of felt the entire movie to me. I thought Jason Clarke was pretty terrible in the film. I don't think they even knew what to do with the Victor Pascal character in the slightest. He's just kind of a jerky ghost in the movie. The whole movie, I could not wrap my head around what people saw in this movie when they saw it out of South by Southwest. I mean, I went in so interested in this movie just to see if they were going to tackle that stuff that Stephen King, put into a story. And people might forget, he actually wrote the screenplay to the 1989 version.
Yeah.
So any butchering of that film, he actually did himself.
Right.
I the whole way through, and at the end of the movie, I was just like, oh, jerks.
No, I thought it was great. I thought it was great. I even liked the new version of the song.
You did.
I do.
No, I do.
I'm sorry.
No,
it's not the Ramones.
By Space Crawler, whatever the name of the band is.
Yeah, I liked it.
Redoing the Ramones song.
Yeah, I liked it.
Telling
you, I thought this movie, I thought it was great. I thought it was, I thought it was really, really scary and deeply twisted. And I'm with it, man. I'm like 100%. I'm 100% on board with this movie. I'm not kidding.
I think they just took Stephen King's book and script and buried it in the sour ground, and it came out crappier.
Yeah, I totally disagree. So, all right. Well,
wow.
All right, Jim. Thanks, man. Wait, what do we got next week? We got What's the big one next
Hellboy.
Week?
Hellboy.
Oh, Hellboy. And wait a minute, Missing Link. That's bigger.
Missing Link is next week?
Yes. Come on, man.
Oh, man.
That's the one.
Yeah. I keep forgetting that that's Laika.
It is Laika, man.
It doesn't look like a Laika movie to me.
I don't know. I'm in, man.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Once I was reminded it was Laika, I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. So we got that next week. All right, Jim. Thanks, buddy.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, we'll talk
always.
To you next week. There you go. There's Jim. All right, Eric. Why don't we jump into some box office here?
Okay.
So the number one movie of the week, which is not a real surprise. Was of course Shazam. Did it do what people expected? Did it outperform or what?
I think it overperformed what the tracking services were saying. They kind of had it in the low 40s. I was thinking somewhere low to mid 50s, and that's where it ended up. It kind of increased in business over the weekend. It is the lowest grossing or lowest opening weekend in the DC universe. But you know, it's Shazam versus Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman,
right?
So Shazam is kind of like the Ant-Man right now of the DC universe.
Right, right.
And so it came close to grossing what Ant-Man did, actually. And I think that this movie is actually going to have the kind of word of mouth that, like, the Spider-Verse film had. It has that sort of that level of, I didn't even talk about it, how I think this movie is a real kind of special movie about family and inclusion and all kinds of things like that. And it's got a lot of really positive messages for it. So I think families are really going to be on board with this one, and you might see it, the business grow a little bit over the next few weeks.
Okay. I'd be interested to see what happens. So,
yeah.
All right. Pet Sematary, $25 million. That underperformed, or
no? That's kind of where people kind of had it. I thought that it could do better just because name recognition, and it just seemed like people were ready for this thing. I don't know if Paramount didn't do a great job advertising it or what, but it's $25 million is certainly not a terrible opening. But I'm running the numbers on it. I'm actually curious if it's actually going to maybe not outgross the 1989 version.
Yeah.
Just looking at movies that horror movies in its sort of realm, I kind of have a sort of comparison to the remakes of Evil Dead and Poltergeist, which had really big drops in their second weekends. And I think that there's a possibility that if this movie does make more than the 89 version, it's not going to be by much.
Yeah. Well, I thought it would make more than $25 million. I thought it would have a much bigger opening than that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Number three is Dumbo. $18.2 million. $76 million total. By the way, you were not here last week.
No.
I hated Dumbo.
Really?
I hated it. Have you seen it?
I have not seen it yet, no.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, people don't like it.
Oh, my God, I hate
and
it.
And audiences apparently are not caring about it either.
Yeah.
Because this is a movie that the production budget was like $170
million. Jeez.
So this thing needs about a half billion to break even, and it's just over $200 million worldwide. This thing, is behind the 10-day grosses of, Wild Hogs, for God's sake.
Oh.
On the Disney line, and Lilo and Stitch, which grossed $145 million total, it's likely going to do less than that.
Yeah. I mean,
so
yeah.
This is kind of a disaster for Disney.
Yeah. Number four is Us, $13.8 million up to $152 million. Is it going to reach Get Out?
It's going to pass Get Out.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to pass Get Out. The only question is and whether it's forging a path towards $200 million at the moment. So it's going to be probably the second highest grossing horror film of all time behind It.
Wow.
Not too shabby.
No, not bad for his second movie. Number five, Captain Marvel, $12.6 million. That's still doing solid numbers.
Oh, it's doing incredible numbers. It's now the 30th highest grossing film of all time.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's doing pretty well. It's reached $1 billion, and it just continues to climb.
I'm just happy for Brie Larson because I really like her.
Sure.
So that's that.
Yeah.
Number six, The Best of Enemies, $4.5 million. That's about what everybody would thought would.
Yeah. It was only released in 1,700 theaters, so you weren't going to get a huge number there. The critics weren't we're pretty mixed on it.
Yeah.
So I'm not expecting anything much larger than that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number 7, 5 feet apart, $3.7 million. It's up to $41.5 million. I guess that's pretty.
That's a solid little hit. Yeah. I mean, a $7 million budget, and it's going to almost make $50 million. That's a solid hit.
Okay. And then Unplanned, $3.2 million.
Yeah.
Its total is at $12.4 million. Number 9, Wonder Park. $41 million. How long has that been out? 3 weeks now? 4 weeks?
Four weeks.
4 weeks.
Came out the week before us.
Oof. Oh, wow.
That's a $100 million animated production right there.
Wow. And then How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, $1.9 million, $156 million. How much less is that than the others?
It's about $20 million less than the second film, about $60 million less than the first film.
Mm.
But, you know, it's over $500 million worldwide, and the film doesn't cost as much as, you know, some of these other films have. It's certainly no Wonder Park. It is definitely a hit.
All right. So you think Little is going to be the number one movie next week?
Oh, gosh. I don't know, honestly. I mean, I don't know what kind of taste people are going to have for Hellboy.
Yeah.
They tried this twice already, and both times it lost money.
Yeah.
And now Lionsgate it's the third studio to put out a third different Hellboy movie.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah. And this one's not Del Toro. I think there's some curiosity for it. I understand in a lot of markets it might not even be getting screened, or at least people aren't getting invites to it.
Right.
It's screening here in Chicago, so people are going. There will be reviews of it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I can't really gauge what Little is going to do too.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen a lot of advertisements for that.
Yeah.
And it's strange that, you know, Shazam was, you know, we had a superhero movie that was kind of like big, and next week we got a superhero movie, a comic book movie, and a movie that is basically big entirely in reverse.
Right. Exactly. All right. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens, man. All right, Eric.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Talk to you next week. Eric Childress and Jim Laskowski will join me again next Monday for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews and the box office as well. All right, we'll take a quick break right here on 720 WGN. Watch for Chicago's very own stories with Micah and Joe, Micah Mateer and Joe Donlin, weeknights on WGN TV News at 9. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey-jokey time. And, we have I'm going to jump in here to this conversation about the worst Saturday Night Live hosts of all time. This is according to twofab.com, and they picked 19 SNL hosts and ranked them from bad to worst. So some people are just not cut out to host Saturday Night Live. For instance, as great an actor as Robert De Niro is, SNL is not his forte. And even though he did get to play Mueller, for a few episodes, this season, but, he's another one of those guys that relies entirely on the cue cards and is, you know, it's just not his thing. He's a tremendous actor, obviously.
Of course.
But some people are just not cut out for SNL.
Seems a little bit of like stunt casting in that sense. Like, yeah, wouldn't it be funny to see Robert De Niro doing something wacky?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, he's hosted, he's hosted like 5-6 times. And, what was funny is that I remember when the Meet the Fokker movies came out, which I'm not a fan of at all. I like the original Meet the Parents, the original film that Emo Phillips made. I thought that was great, but not a big fan of the Ben Stiller, you know, De Niro movies at all. But I remember when it came out, everybody was like, wow, Robert De Niro's in a comedy. Robert De Niro's going to be funny. People seem to forget that he's funny in a lot of movies. Like, there's hilarious stuff in Raging Bull. Like, the stuff between him and Joe Pesci is hilarious. There's really funny stuff in it.
Mm-hmm.
Midnight Run.
Oh, man, him and Charles Grodin?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
One of the best, like, buddy movies.
It's that's one of those, I've talked about this on the show before, that I have a category called remote droppers, meaning that if this movie's on, that's it. I'm dropping the remote and I'm going to watch it no matter how far into the movie it is or what part of the movie it is. Midnight Run is way up on the list of remote droppers for me. I could watch that movie 24 hours a day if necessary. I love that movie.
Any point in any scene,
yeah,
the minute you see it,
absolutely,
just forget whatever you were
that's
doing
exactly
for the rest of the
right
day.
That's exactly right. And I feel that way about Midnight Run. Midnight Run is just and De Niro's hilarious in it.
He's so perfect.
He's really funny. And him and Durning together, Charles Durning, Grodin. Him and Grodin together, fantastic. Like really, really funny. So, but yeah, you know, but he's just not the strongest person to host SNL. And they picked out, now in this article, I do want to mention that they actually picked specific episodes, not just a general, you know, not just a general, this person's not good at SNL, but they actually pick a specific episode because there are, a couple of people on this list who, I'm thinking of one person in particular who was hosted more than once and had been good. But this particular episode was not. So what do you guys think? 312-981-7200. I don't know if you watched this week, Kit Harington was not the best, was not the best host that you could imagine. And again, I don't want to, you know, pin the whole thing on him because the writers didn't give him much to do. It wasn't a very well written episode either. So he didn't have a lot to work with, but he was not very good. So here's what they say. Even when Saturday Night Live has a strong cast, it can still have episodes that bomb completely because of a bad host. So for many wonderful hosts and episodes, as we've seen over the past 40 plus years, there have been some hosts that are so bad that they have lived in infamy for all the wrong reasons. Sports figures and politicians figure somewhat heavily on this list, which makes sense, as these are people who are not actors or comedians, but that doesn't give SNL or them a pass. They were cast, and they agreed to do the show, which sounds like two strikes. The third strike came on how awful they were when the cameras began rolling. A little more surprising are the quality actors who nevertheless have earned the dubious honor of being an SNL disaster, most of them serious dramatic actors and actresses who just can't seem to get the timing right for comedy. And then there are those people with no discernible skills, or those who clearly were phoning it in and had little interest in putting forth any effort for that week when they joined the Not Ready for Primetime Players. So these are the worst. So, but again, these are specific... episodes. They really tear into Charles Barkley here.
Yeah, no mercy on Charles.
They had 4 episodes that he's hosted. September 25th, 1993, January 9th, 2010, January 7th, 2012, and March of 2018. He's been back 4 times primarily because he's game for anything, and yet even his most recent stint proved that he was still incredibly awkward and difficult to watch, stumbling over his mumbled lines and seeming uncertain of what's going on at any given moment. His monotone delivery and dazed expressions just made it look like he's in over his head every time. I think they're being a little tough on Barkley.
I never thought he was terrible, but definitely maybe middle of the pack.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't think he. I don't know, because I mean there are times. There are times when he cracked me up hosting on SNL. I mean, he's not the obviously, you know.
No.
Again, as they mentioned in the introduction here, it's, you know, you're gonna either get a terrible show or you're gonna get lucky when they have an athlete host. That, you know, it's always like that's always the trick. It's like, okay, what's gonna happen here? Either this person is gonna be really funny and naturally funny, or it's just not gonna work at all. Barkley, I think, has moments. I think there have been much worse athletes that have hosted SNL than Barkley. I think they're giving him a bit of a rough time here, but he wasn't great, clearly. But I don't know. I could name 5-6 athletes immediately that were worse than Barkley. So, all right, we've got to take a break. What do you guys think? Worst host of SNL? We're also going to talk about some of the guests and musical, some of the hosts and musical guests who were the worst behaved in SNL history. And some of the behind-the-scenes stories about that, and those are always fun. So, all right, 312-981-7200 for talk and text. The news is coming up right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here till 5 a.m. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey-jokey time, as he does every Monday morning. And we're talking SNL right now. Some people are cut out to be a good host on SNL. Some people just aren't, even if they're terrific actors. And they put together this list at twofab.com where they're ranking the worst SNL hosts of all time. And they've already mentioned they go from bad to the worst. And having looked at the list, I have to say that their choice for number one, I disagree with vehemently as the worst host. I disagree with really vehemently, but we'll get to that in a second. 312-981-7200 is if you want to jump in. 608 area code says Betty White has been a great host. Yeah, Betty White hosted because of the internet. There was this petition to get Betty host, but to Betty White host, and she was funny. She was very funny. They did the sketch where the Scared Straight sketch where Kenan Thompson always plays the convict that they bring in to scare the three guys, the three kids.
Yeah.
Always one of, and she came in as his partner in that one. I love those. Those sketches always crack me up. First of all, Kenan Thompson rules. I love Kenan Thompson.
Almost every single one of his signature sketches are generally really good.
Yeah. I mean, What's Up With That is one of the funniest things.
Lindsey Buckingham.
Yeah, but the thing about I remember the first time I saw What's Up With That, my ex-wife and I were watching, and we were laughing our asses off, and then when it was over, we were like, was that the stupidest thing I've ever seen? Because it really was stupid, and I just couldn't explain. I was like, why am I laughing so hard at this? But I mean, it's just a simple, it's just such a stupid concept. He just, he keeps, interrupting what is supposed to be a talk show so he can sing the theme song some more. And it gets more ridiculous. They bring out more guests, to sing in the song. And for me, one of the keys to why that sketch was so funny is Jason Sudeikis in the red tracksuit.
Yeah.
Dancing around, with the wig and the gold chain. There's no explanation for it. I don't know.
No.
But yeah. So I mean, I'm a big fan of Kenan Thompson. But yeah. and that running gag that they did, where it was usually Hader, Andy Samberg, and usually Moynihan were the three guys that Bobby Moynihan were the three guys that were going to be scared straight. And Sudeikis always played the police chief. And then Thompson would come in, and whoever the host was would be his partner, to scare them. And it was so funny because they would break constantly. Hader would break constantly during that, because he would take his shoe. Remember, he would take Hader's shoe and throw it. And then Sudeikis would break too. But yeah, those are great. Those are great sketches. And Betty White was really funny in that sketch that they did. She was good. 218 area code says, Nick, can you watch an awkward performance? I feel so embarrassed for the person who's bombing on SNL or any live TV broadcast, really, that I usually fast forward through all the awful quietness or awkward acting because I just can't withstand it. Also, can we get a weekly review show of the weekend of the weekend's SNL? Well, I mean, yeah, I used to do live grades during the show, and I stopped doing that because it was just a pain in the neck. I would grade every sketch every moment,
really?
Live as on Facebook as it was going, and I just got like I was getting distracted and I couldn't concentrate on the show and I was just you know. So people were upset on my Facebook page because I don't do that anymore, but I want to enjoy the show or not enjoy it, depending on what the case may be. But yeah, I mean, I watch it every week. I don't miss it. I mean, I've been watching SNL since the very first episode. In 1975, I vividly remember watching the first episode. George Carlin was the host, and I've been watching it ever since.
That honestly blows my mind, Nick, that you've seen every single episode of SNL as it airs, or do you ever DVR it?
Oh, I DVR. Oh, yeah, I mean, back in the day, there was no DVR.
Right.
There was no DVR.
Would you ever tape it?
I did tape it. Yeah, okay. I would tape it. A lot of the times because I would tape it because I was sometimes I was on the air because I had a Saturday evening show, and sometimes I'd be on the air, so of course I would tape it. In that regard. But yeah, I mean, I watch it. I pretty much watch it live. My Saturday nights, this is how I party. My Saturday nights consist of Svengoolie.
Oh, well, you got it, though.
And I watch Svengoolie, and then it's SNL because they show a rerun at 9. So Svengoolie is on from 7 to 9. And then they show a rerun, like Peter Dinklage, the Peter Dinklage Gwen Stefani was on. On Saturday night at 9, and then it's live at 10:30. You know, I usually watch either the news or Pat Tomasulo. I'll watch Pat Tomasulo's show, and then Saturday Night Live. So, I mean, I do watch it live because I don't really go out anymore. You know, when I used to go out drinking and stuff, then I would tape it. But but I watch it live. And so I've seen all of the episodes. and there are some lean years in there, man.
Of course.
Like 1980 was a tough year, like when the original cast left and they brought in the new cast, and that was back in the day when the only person worth watching in the cast was Eddie Murphy. That was like when he and Joe Piscopo, oddly enough, who's not very funny now, but he and Piscopo basically carried that show until they got new cast members. And then there was the whole time when Lorne Michaels was gone. He was gone for a few years, and that's when it kind of suffered. And when he came back, he brought in new cast members, there were some strange choices. Like for instance, Robert Downey Jr. and Anthony Michael Hall, Joan Cusack was a cast member during that time.
I always forget about that.
Oh yeah. And people forget. People forget that Martin Short. Billy Crystal and Spinal Tap, but married to Jamie
Christopher Guest?
Yes, Christopher Guest. They were only on for one season. Everybody thinks they were on longer, but because that season, they made such a strong impression that they were like, oh yeah, they were only on one season. Those guys were only on one season, but they made such a huge impression. So, but yeah. So being a host, not an easy gig, it's also, as people have said, it's the craziest week you could possibly imagine. Very rarely the writers and the cast members always talk about how there's like no sleep, that they stay, at 30 Rock, and write till 5 o'clock in the morning, all week long. And the rehearsal process is crazy. And then you've got the dress rehearsal, and then you've got the live show. And it depends on who you get. I remember one of the most impressive hosts for me the first time he hosted was Jon Hamm. I thought Jon Hamm was unbelievable.
Oh, man.
And this was before we knew how funny he was, because I just knew him as Draper. I was like,
sure.
I wonder if this guy's going to be funny.
This was before he had his cameos on 30 Rock.
Absolutely. It was before that. It was before Bridesmaids. It was before we realized that Jon Hamm is hilarious.
Yeah.
Like, really hilarious. I only knew him from Mad Men. So he hosts the show. Not only did he kill, not only was he hilarious, like right out of the gate, but they threw an audible. They called an audible on him. I don't know if you know this story, but those fantastic Vincent Price special sketches Bill Hader, because Bill Hader. I by the way, I interviewed. I did the Q&A and I interviewed. Victoria Price, who was Vincent Price's daughter.
Oh, wow.
And she was at Flashback a couple of years ago. And I asked her, I was like, do you like Hader's, you know, Bill Hader's impression of your dad? And she's like, I love it. I think it's great. I've already, you know, he reached out to us. You know, he reached out to me and wanted to make sure it was okay. And, you know, and he, and she said my dad would have loved it. My dad would have just.
I mean, it's spot on.
It's hilarious, too. And he's all, and he's, the thing is, like, he's the one trying to do the, you know, like, the setup is that he's the one who's trying to do a good show and everybody else is screwing around.
He's the straight man.
Exactly. Exactly. But anyway, so he, John Hamm was on one of those, and it was, the Halloween special, you know, there's the Vincent Price Halloween special, and, you know, Fred Armisen as Liberace. Which is hysterical. And then it was, on this particular one, it was Kristen Wiig was Gloria Swanson.
Yeah, yeah.
And then John Hamm was James Mason.
Uh-huh.
All right, so now what they did was, because in for some reason in dress rehearsal, well, the thing was he was supposed to do Dean Martin. And so, like, and that's what it was for the way it was written. The way it was rehearsed, and at dress rehearsal, it was Dean Martin. And so between dress and the live show, they said, hey, we'd like to change this to James Mason. Can you do James Mason? He's like, all right. And his James Mason was unbelievable. And it was literally an hour before he had to do it. They said, yeah, you're going to be James Mason now. He's like, all right. And his James Mason was hysterical. He was hilarious.
Yeah. Like, it makes you wonder if he was practicing that in the mirror, like maybe way before SNL.
I have no idea.
What does he say about the horse?
Yeah, it's like, say, Price, where are the whores? it's just hilarious, man. He's actually one of those guys that can pretty much do anything. The whole Ham and Bubbly when Michael Bublé, Ham and Bubbly.
John Ham's John Ham.
Yeah, yeah. Hilarious. All right. Here are bad hosts. Now we mentioned Charles Barkley, who made the list. Next is George Steinbrenner. This is absolutely, it was October 20th, 1990. George Steinbrenner, even being asked to host, is proof that sometimes SNL is too New York for its own good. Outside of the Big Apple, Steinbrenner was best known for the Seinfeld parody of him, but this was an actual comedic performance. The actual Yankees owner was a sports businessman, and that's about it. He's just not a funny guy, and even though he clearly had affection for the show, he was proof that the show should vet these hosts at least a little bit. Yeah, that was painful. I got to say, that was painful.
They included a clip on the online version of this article, and it's
brutal.
Hard to watch.
Yeah, no, it was brutal. It was brutal. All right, let's take a quick break. Who are you think are some of the worst hosts in SNL? And we're going to talk about badly behaved guests, musical guests and hosts with great, some really, really great behind-the-scenes stories. 312-981-7200 for talk and text. And we'll continue with more after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. And coming up at 6 a.m. is the great Steve Cochran for your morning drive. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right. We've been talking about the worst hosts in SNL history. So far, we've got Charles Barkley. This is and George Steinbrenner. And the George Steinbrenner episode was really brutal. And this is according to TwoFab.com. They're ranking them from bad to the worst. 847 area code says, I love Liev Schreiber, but not hosting SNL. His episode was brutal. It really was. It really, and he's great. And he can be very funny. He can be very, very funny. That was a pretty brutal episode. So, all right, let's get back to it. How about this one? Frank Zappa, October 21st, 1978. Frank Zappa couldn't be bothered to take the show seriously undermining the cast and crew at seemingly every turn. Yes, this is comedy, but these people work hard to make quality entertainment. They don't need a musician heckling the cue card guys live during a sketch and trying to break the fourth wall constantly like he's too cool for the gig. Yeah, it was it was very jerky of Zappa. I mean, I remember the episode, and they've actually played clips from that particular episode, but he really was it was painful. It was painful.
Yeah, I can't imagine that Zappa would have been too thrilled to be doing that. It didn't really seem like his singing.
No, absolutely not. How about this one? Nancy Kerrigan. She was on. She was a host on March 12, 1994. Nancy Kerrigan was America's sweetheart on the ice in the early 90s, but that doesn't mean she is an actress of any particular caliber or talent. In fact, she was quite atrocious as an actress, giving a completely flat performance. Clearly out of her element and hired only because of the heights of her popularity she had achieved on both the ice and for getting her knee plugged prior to the 94 Olympics. Sometimes cashing in on a hot popular craze isn't worth it. And they do that pretty regularly. You know, that's another thing that every season of SNL has been pretty guilty of. It's like, who's hot at the moment? Let's put them in. You know, like Nancy Kerrigan, you know, that was just people knew her from her ice skating, but mostly because of the tabloid stuff that was going on.
Yeah, it just seems like bad timing to put her on a massive platform like that after experiencing something clearly traumatic.
Yeah. Well, she was everywhere, though. I mean,
sure,
as you know.
Sure.
You seen I, Tonya?
Yeah.
I love that movie.
I thought it was great. I didn't think I was going to like it. I really didn't, because it felt like a little bit too much Goodfellas for ice skating.
That's exactly what it is.
It's what it is, but it works.
Oh, it totally works.
It totally works.
I think it's great.
I was blown away. Can't believe how much I enjoyed it.
No, I thought it was great. I also thought it was really funny. Like, really. And I, you know, why am I blanking on her name? Who played Tonya?
Margot Robbie.
Yeah, Margot Robbie. I thought she was great.
Yeah.
I thought
yeah.
she was so funny in it and so good. Yeah. All right, how about this? Rudy Giuliani, he hosted on November 22nd, 1997, so he hosted a Thanksgiving show. Rudy Giuliani was a charismatic and beloved guy, but he was also the acting mayor of New York, and this was back when political figures were expected to act within a certain level of decorum and professionalism at all times. That meant that Giuliani was somewhat limited in what he could do for the sake of comedy, neutering the potential of the show. Add to this the fact that he's not an actor or a comedian, and you've just got awkward performer on safe material, and it just adds up to a disastrous night. Yeah. Yeah. When did Rudy Giuliani lose his mind? When did that happen? Do we know?
I don't know. Although I have to say, one of the funnier, and obviously it was completely written and all that kind of stuff, or I assume it was, but the first SNL after 9/11, when they had
start now?
Yeah, I thought that was a legitimately pretty funny moment.
Well, it was fun. I mean, you know, people talk, but that was Amy Poehler's first show.
Really? Her first show was the first one after now.
Amy Poehler
and
somebody else too. Sandberg? It was their first show.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
How do you even? I mean, it was hard enough, I'm sure, for the rest
for
of the
everybody.
Cast.
Yeah.
And then it's your first show.
Well, I thought they did. I thought they did a nice job.
They did.
I thought they did a nice job with it. Bringing, you know, having Paul Simon out to sing The Boxer was really beautiful. And then having, you know, all the firefighters and the cops. The New York firefighters and the cops there. Mm-hmm. It was a beautiful opening. And, you know, Giuliani got the first laugh of the night.
Yeah.
Which I thought was appropriate, you know. I will say this, though. You know, everybody, you know, because obviously when 9/11 happened, how old were you? You were just a kid, right?
Yeah, I wasn't even in the country.
No?
I was living in Singapore at the time, so things were like...
That must have been really weird.
It was, yeah, my mom woke me up in the middle of the night and was just like, how do I explain this to my 7-year-old son is happening literally thousands and thousands of miles away?
Obviously nobody knew what to do. Nobody knew what to say. We didn't know if, you know, comedy was dead at that time. Can we be funny anymore? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff. But I'll say this. You know, you were only a kid. Have you since gone back and looked at the issue with the Onion that came out right after 9/11?
I haven't, no.
Oh, man.
Did they just go for it?
Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And it was, you know, they they took a couple of weeks off too, you know, because nobody knew
of course
whether you could be funny or not. And it is, I still have the hard copy of it at home. I'll never forget it. We were at Simon's, and everybody was still trying to process what was going on. We're at Simon's, and they Simon's always had the onion dropped off at the front door on Thursday night. They would always drop the onion off at the front door. And so I remember a whole group of us were at Simon's, and the 9/11 issue came out, and we all like ran up to the front door and each grabbed a copy, and we all just started looking at it. And it was, not only is it brilliant, and no holds barred too. They went for it. They went full on. It was only a couple of weeks afterwards. It was also one of the sort of beautiful healing moments that we all had. Like, we were in that room and everybody was reading this, and we were almost crying because, you know, like one of the most poignant headlines was woman doesn't know what to do, so she bakes an American flag cake. That was one of the headlines. And it was like, it was very, very funny, and it was also like true. And one of the other headlines was the world becomes a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. It was that kind of,
oh my God,
that kind of stuff. And you know, terrorist surprised that they're in hell, and there's no, there aren't 21 virgins waiting for them. Like, it was that kind of stuff,
right?
But like, even more pointed and even more brilliant.
Sure.
And again, they didn't hedge their bets on it, man. And they went for it, and it was great. And I thought SNL did a nice job, but nothing topped
the onion.
That onion. If you go back, man, and
I'll pull it up,
and look at it, because it's really, really brilliant. So, all right, let's take a break here, because we got the news coming up, and then we got more SNL hosts that left a lot to be desired, to say the least. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we're here until 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey-jokey time. It's Monday morning. And, yeah, right now we are talking about the worst hosts in SNL history, and this website called TwoFab.com ranked them from bad to worst. And we've been going back. And what do you guys think? 312-981-7200. 708 area code says, Ellen Page was a bad host. Yeah, she wasn't great. And I love her. I think she's fantastic. But she was not, she didn't seem the most comfortable with what was going on. 219 area code says, didn't care for Matthew Broderick. Well, you know, Matthew Broderick, I don't know how many times he's hosted. I think he's hosted more than once. But Matthew Broderick's in one of the most notorious SNL sketches of all time.
Which was that?
That's the it was the nudist colony sketch, where they broke the record for saying penis the most in any sketch. Yeah,
I mean, how many times?
Oh, I can't even.
Numerous.
Well, and Conan O'Brien wrote the sketch.
Oh, of course,
Conan O'Brien wrote the sketch. It's like, hey, how's your penis? Hey, good, nice penis. Yeah, good penis. I'm not kidding. It goes on forever. Matthew Broderick's in that sketch. It's like Rob Schneider, David Spade is in that one.
Boy,
it was that time period. You know what I mean? It was like early 90s.
Oh.
And Conan O'Brien wrote that sketch. And I remember they were doing it. They were talking about the sketch is pretty infamous now. You know, I mean, it's gone on. It's got an aura of its own at this point. But every time they talk about it, Conan O'Brien was like, we did this on purpose, because he and Smigel wrote it. And yeah, of course. And so they did this on purpose, thinking that it was never going to get on. It was never going to make it to air. Like, there's no way that they're going to allow, there's no way Lauren is going to allow this to go on air. And it did. And there were so many complaints. It was like, there were so, like, the NBC phone lines just lit up after that.
So Conan's got under his belt one of the most infamous SNL sketches of all time, and then the best episode of The Simpsons.
The monorail.
Yeah, the monorail.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He wrote that too, yeah. The other thing is, you know, but that's not the time. Do you know, can you actually there were two other times when the phone lines went berserk for SNL. One we're going to get to when we talk about musical guests was Sinead O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
When she tore up the picture of the Pope, and I remember my girlfriend and I watching it. My girlfriend at the time and I watching it, and like she did that, and I just went, did she just tear up a picture of the Pope and say fight the real enemy? You know, my girlfriend and I were like stunned. I'll tell you what, it was a pretty incredible piece of live television, you know, there was that. So there's that. But the other sketch that of course had the most insane phone calls and complaints was Canteen Boy, which just have you seen Canteen Boy?
I think so.
Oh yeah. Man, no, you'd remember if you saw Canteen Boy.
Okay, maybe I.
It's Adam Sandler. Adam Sandler, you know, doing like the Canteen Boy, but like doing like the you know what he did with Waterboy,
yeah,
that kind of thing. Like he clearly maybe, you know. He may be mentally challenged.
Oh, this is with Alec Baldwin. Yeah,
as the Boy Scout leader.
Yep. Oh, geez,
man. The complaints for that. I mean, the phone lines went nuts when they ran that. Yeah. Canteen Boy.
Probably a few complaints from the Boy Scouts of America.
I would imagine everybody. I mean, it was just. I remember watching it. I remember watching it going, oh my god. I can't. I think it's funny, and Alec Baldwin so sells it. Like he is. You know. I mean, because he's great. I mean, you know, yeah. on the show. But yeah, that was the one that prompted the most complaints was Canteen Boy. All right, other bad ones here. We just mentioned Rudy Giuliani. How about Al Sharpton? He hosted December 6th of 2003. Al Sharpton had the misfortune of hosting during one of the show's down periods. And it doesn't excuse his over-the-top and somehow still completely lost performance technique. Sharpton looked alternately like he'd rather be anywhere else than Studio 8H and like he wasn't sure where he was. It was as if someone had convinced him to take the job and he felt obligated to do it, but he was offended by everything happening around him. And then they write here that they would have been better off just having Kenan Thompson play him.
An astute observation.
Yeah. Justin Bieber. Oh, that was terrible. Justin Bieber hosted on February 9th of 2013. He was the biggest pop star on the planet, and it showed in his every utterance, every cooing for the camera, every moment on camera. No one drank the Kool-Aid of their own awesomeness more than the Biebs, making him a nightmare to work with and someone who really couldn't be bothered to work about learning lines or what he was supposed to be doing on camera. Have you seen how cute he is? He shouldn't have to work for this, is what they're saying. And apparently he was a nightmare. Like I've got the bad behavior list over here. Apparently he was a total nightmare to work with. Everybody who worked on that episode was like this kid. So yeah.
And that's like past cute stage Bieber when he first jumped onto the scene. This is like doing some weird stuff, covered in tattoos.
Yeah.
Not super cool.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Next one on the list is Lindsay Lohan. Now, again, this is a specific episode because when she first hosted the show, she was great. The first time she hosted.
Because that was Debbie Downer.
Debbie Downer.
Amazing.
They did the Harry Potter thing where she was Hermione developed over the summer. there was a lot of funny stuff on that show, and she was really good. That was at the time, like, you know, during the peak of like the popularity of Mean Girls and all that stuff. And that was when I loved Lindsay Lohan.
Yeah, who didn't?
Yeah, I mean, I was like predicting Oscars for her future. I thought she was the best.
I was head over heels.
Yeah, you were the correct age at that time too. But Lindsay Lohan returned for her fourth hosting stint. But by this point, her career had spiraled beyond the point of no return, and the it girl of the mid-2000s was nowhere to be seen. The Mean Girls star achieved fame thanks to Lorne Michaels and Tina Fey. So the show was trying to do her a solid, but her line deliveries were still flat, and she was struggling to read the cue cards most of the night. Yeah, it was bad. It was bad. And it was at this point that her career was just, you know, it had clearly there had been some bad choices made, and she couldn't recover. There was no way she could recover. Lance Armstrong is considered a terrible host. He hosted on October 29th, 2005. Lance Armstrong had yet to be fully disgraced, but was embroiled in the doping scandal that began his downfall. Mostly, though, he was still beloved as the cancer survivor who became a cycling legend, but he was quick to prove that just because he can stay upright on a bike doesn't mean he can navigate sketch comedy with any charm or charisma. Armstrong was very stiff and painfully difficult to watch. I remember that episode, too.
Was that like a savior move for his career, like hoping that maybe if he could earn some goodwill?
He wasn't fully...
Fully embroiled yet?
No, not at that point. How about this? Deion Sanders. Man, this was a brutal episode. February 18th, 1995, Deion Sanders was charming and likable in interviews and had a great sense of humor, and he had that cool factor to the max. This totally should have worked, but when he decided he wanted to be his own musical guest as well, even though Bon Jovi were already there, because Deion can rap. Didn't you know that? No, it's because he really can't. He just used his clout to force the issue and forced everyone to endure two tracks on top of his lackluster comedic skills. Yeah.
Well, at least we didn't have to sit through Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
Which is worse?
No, we did have to sit through Bon Jovi.
Oh, they still did Bon Jovi.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Wow.
How about this? MC Hammer. I don't agree with this one. MC Hammer. December 7th, 1991. I remember watching this episode. MC Hammer was a big deal for such a short span, but his star was already fading by the time he hosted SNL. He had just ditched the MC part of his name and tried to stay relevant. It was his lackluster acting and desperate attempts to look hip and cool. It was clear that Hammer knew things weren't going good for him in the world of hip-hop, so this might be a last chance to stay relevant, and he blew it. I don't necessarily agree with that, because there was some funny stuff in that episode. And that's when he did Too Legit to Quit.
Nice.
And he did the Addams Family.
Oh, man.
From the Addams Family movie. And he had 27,000 people on stage. You know, like, he brought, like, a massive entourage. That's why Hammer went broke, because he hired all of his friends. Every cousin, every friend that he ever had, everybody came out of the woodwork, and he gave him a salary, you know, and that's how he went broke. He was too generous with his money. But there was, I remember specifically, there was one sketch that just completely cracked me up, and he was very funny in it, and it was a sketch about where people were at a support group for people with bad haircuts. I remember specifically Hammer being really, really funny in that sketch, because he was there to support somebody. But, you know Hammer's hair at that time.
Yeah, crazy hair.
And so they were like, they made the assumption that he was there because of his own bad haircut. And he went, "My hair's not bad. That's a bad haircut." And he's pointing at everybody else in the other, in the group. "That's a bad haircut. That's a bad haircut." I remember cracking up at that. So I don't think I didn't think Hammer was that bad. Donald Trump, yes, a disaster. He hosted in April of 2004, and then he hosted in November of 2015. Donald Trump does one thing well, and that's just to be Donald Trump. His tremendous ego is too fragile to allow him to step outside of the carefully crafted persona and poke fun at his foibles or even show an ounce of humility. His first appearance was all apprentice hype. His second was even more safe, as he was running for president. In other words, he wasn't willing to get down and dirty and even try to be funny, and it showed. Yeah, both times painful. Absolutely painful. Especially in 15, especially in 2015. Whoa. All right, let's take a quick break, and then we're going to get to more of the worst Saturday Night Live hosts of all time, and then we've got some really bad behavior that was backstage that a lot of people, cast members, have talked about. That's all coming up. 312-981-7200 is the phone number for talk and text. We'll be right back. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. It's Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's a jokey time. We've been talking about the worst hosts in SNL history. And they were ranked here from bad to the worst. We've got Charles Barkley, George Steinbrenner, Frank Zappa, Nancy Kerrigan, Rudy Giuliani, Al Sharpton, Justin Bieber, Lindsay Lohan, Lance Armstrong, Deion Sanders, MC Hammer so far, and then Donald Trump. Now we continue on with Michael Phelps, who hosted September 13th, 2008. Michael Phelps had as much charisma on camera as a dead fish. His performances were uncomfortable to watch as he struggled to read cue cards throughout the night, meaning he wasn't even remotely emoting or presenting the material as written. Think of the poor readers in middle school who bogged down in class reading material and killed the narrative as they fumbled through their lines. It was only slightly better than that. Adrian Brody, May 10th, 2003. Adrian Brody was riding high off of his Oscar win and onstage sexual assault of Halle Berry when he forced her to kiss him. And he brought all that arrogance to SNL. Brody clearly thought he was not only having a big career moment, but that he had arrived and would be Hollywood's biggest star for years to come. He was painfully unfunny on that night, and he sealed his fate with an unapproved, tone-deaf introduction of musical guest Sean Paul, complete with dreadlocks and bad Jamaican accent. He thought he could do no wrong, but it turned out he couldn't do no right. He's been banned from SNL for life.
Really?
Because of that. You don't do something that's not approved.
Oh, yeah, no way.
By Lauren. If Lauren doesn't approve it, you don't do it.
Well, isn't that why Elvis Costello got banned for life? Because of Radio Radio.
Yeah. Yep. That's part of that article that I'm going to be talking about the bad behavior. That was painful. The whole dreadlocks thing, I don't even, you know, and it went on and on and on. All you're supposed to say is, ladies and gentlemen, Sean Paul. Or for the second musical performance, you say, ladies and gentlemen, once again, Sean Paul. He went on for like minutes with this terrible Jamaican accent and it went on and on. And you know, Lorne Michaels watches the show from the side. He's got a monitor and he watches the show like right from the side of the stage. And you know he was just kind of sitting there looking at the monitor, shaking his head like, this guy's never going to come back. This guy's never going to come back and host this show again.
That's how you get relegated to Predator sequels.
Yeah. Although, you know what? I didn't think that was too bad.
I like it.
Yeah.
But he's doing a Christian Bale impression that really swings for the fences.
Here's one. Man, this is brutal. Steven Seagal. He hosted in April of 1991.
Good Lord.
Steven Seagal was a pretty one-trick pony in his movies. He could kick and punch people and growl through squinted eyes. And that's about all he has as an action star, and he didn't have much more to offer sketch comedy. He had less, in fact. Seagal didn't even have a funny bone in his body, but he had plenty of confidence and arrogance, leading to a performance that was both off-putting and painfully unfunny. That was one of the most brutal episodes I've ever seen. And the behind-the-scenes stories, we'll get to that, too, because he's mentioned in the article about, you know, behind the scenes, how horrible it was to work with the guy.
Probably trying to throat punch everyone.
I just can't even imagine what it would have been like to work with that guy.
When was Under Siege?
92.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So not even
Under Siege. I remember specifically when it was. It was the fall of 1992 because I saw the movie with Gary Busey sitting next to me.
Uh huh.
So that's, I'll never forget that.
Giving you trivia the whole time.
It was like having DVD commentary, right, with Gary Busey sitting next to me. Tommy Lee Jones and I, we improvised this whole thing. That's what I'm hearing while I'm watching the movie. This was brutal. Paris Hilton, she hosted in February of 2005. Paris Hilton was vapid and empty-headed on The Simple Life, and according to the cast of SNL, she was proud of her stupidity. It translated into a terrible hosting gig, as Hilton couldn't be bothered to learn any of her lines and really epitomized the stereotype of a no-talent socialite looking for cash in a paycheck. Yeah, that was brutal.
I know her little bit with Jimmy Fallon on the Weekend Update made it onto his Best Of DVD, Volume 1.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
really know why. I thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Andrew Dice Clay, May of 1990, was the biggest comedian in the world because he told dirty nursery rhymes and said shockingly offensive things. a cartoon character of a real person, the Dice Man didn't have much depth to his crass stage persona, and he had nothing fresh to offer on SNL. In fact, every sketch was a variation of his Dice persona, because he was just too cool to offer anything else. It was painfully unfunny then, and it's aged even worse. I got to say something. First of all, there were boycotts. There were two boycotts. Sinead O'Connor was supposed to be the musical guest. She boycotted. And Nora Dunn, cast member, boycotted because of Dice.
I've never really understood the appeal.
Of Dice?
Yeah.
Oh, I used to think he was hilarious. That first HBO special, The Dice Man Cometh, is hilarious.
Well, he was a rock star. I mean, he was doing stadium comedy on scales that had never been seen before.
I will tell you this. There was an absolutely hilarious sketch in that episode. It wasn't a very strong episode. There were parts of it that were kind of funny, and he was doing his Dice thing. But they did a Raging Bull. Him and John Lovitz did a Raging Bull thing where he was De Niro and Lovitz was Pesci. And it was all about, go ahead, hit me. You know, the whole punch me, whole scene in Raging Bull. It's a variation on that, where it's like he wants him to pick up a refrigerator and smash him over the head with it and stuff. And it was hilarious. And his De Niro is De Niro was very funny. But I remember that Raging Bull sketch. I still remember it to this day. I thought it was hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. All right, number two on the list here of the worst episodes or the worst hosts ever, I would put it as number one. January Jones. She was horrible. And that was, she was in, it was November of 2009 when she hosted. It is truly one of the worst hosting performances I've ever seen. January Jones looked both bored and confused throughout her bland line deliveries. She was every bit Betty Draper of Mad Men, and she simply didn't have time for this, or memorizing her lines, or even realizing that it was a live show. She asked which camera at one point. True. This is where we learned that Betty is maybe less of a performance than we realized, as January had nothing else to offer, botching every sketch she was in. It was brutal. But they save a different person for number one, for being the worst, and I totally disagree. I completely and absolutely disagree with this choice for the worst SNL host of all time. Totally disagree, and we'll get to that after the news, which is coming up after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday and it's a jokey time. And our phone number is 312-981-7200 if you want to jump in. We've been talking about the worst SNL hosts of all time, and they were ranked from bad to the worst according to twofab.com. And we've reached whom they consider to be the worst host of all time. And again, I strongly disagree. They say Tom Green, who hosted in November of 2000. I happen to love Tom Green. I think Tom Green is hilarious. I always have. I think Freddy Got Fingered is a great movie. And I think Tom Green's great. And I loved his show. I thought his show was absolutely hilarious. And I thought he was very funny on SNL. This was when he was dating Drew Barrymore. And they were supposed to get married on the show. And then she stands him up at the end. That's how the show ended. That's how the show ended.
What?
Yeah, I mean, it was a
oh, it was a joke.
Yeah, it was a joke.
Okay,
they ended up getting married. They didn't end up getting married.
I remember that. Yeah.
But I mean, that was like the big. She came out at the beginning. He asked her if she would get married at the end of the show, and she said yes. And then she just ditches him at the end. She doesn't show up. No, I thought that was funny. They did. He and Will Ferrell played birds, and they were crawling around in the balcony, climbing on top of the audience members and stuff. And I thought that was funny. But Tom Green is the product of a very specific jackass generation that found laughter and gross out humor, not requiring anything other than people hurting themselves and being awful. And that's all Green was capable of. He wasn't a comedian, an actor, or anything really, other than someone who was willing to do shocking and uncomfortable things. He tried to bring that to SNL, but it was oil and water with what a real comedy show is all about, and it was awful. And congrats on being the absolute worst, Tom. I totally disagree.
He reminded me I guess the closest analog to him now would be Eric Andre, if you've ever watched the Eric Andre show. Yeah. And I don't know. I get that style of anti-humor.
Well, I think it's hilarious, quite frankly.
Yeah.
Did you see the episode of Tom Green had a talk show called The Tom Green Show.
Right.
Where it was just him interviewing people. Did you see the episode with Eric Andre?
Yeah.
It was like he was meeting his hero.
Yeah.
You know, and it was great.
Yeah.
It was really great.
Many, many interviews Eric Andre's done, he said that the Tom Green Show was like his blueprint for what he wanted to do.
Well, I mean, it's obvious, too, if you watch the Eric Andre Show. But I think that show's hilarious.
I love it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's funny. Because I've actually become friends with Tom Green. I actually know him. And I talked to him several times, and the first time we ever had him on, you know, I told him how much I loved Freddie Got Fingered, and told him what I thought, what the movie was really, and I told him that in my estimation, it's the biggest prank that he's ever pulled on people, was having people pay to see that movie. That was the biggest prank, and he played on 20th Century Fox too, who put up like $20 million for that movie.
And
I think it's the biggest, most elaborate prank that he's ever done. He played a prank on Fox, and he played a prank on people who saw the movie. I said I think the movie's brilliant. I think Freddy Got Fingered is brilliant. For many, many, many reasons. But I've told people lots of times that in order to correctly watch Freddy Got Fingered, you need to turn the chair around and watch the audience watch the movie. That's the idea. You know what I mean? It's like, how is the audience responding to this thing? And I remember they actually screened it for the critics. And I had never been in a room full of more angry people than the critic screening of Freddy Got Fingered. And I was laughing the whole time. Because it was as ridiculous as you could possibly. You've seen it, right?
Too many times.
It's as ridiculous as you can possibly imagine, and goes to places that are just absurd and makes no sense. I mean, and I just was I was giddy throughout the entire movie, and I've never been in a room full of critics who were more angry. And I loved it. I loved that he pissed off everybody in that room. And one of the reasons why I loved it is because at the very end, at that time, Tom Green was dating, or maybe he was married to her at this point, but I know that they were together. No, he was just dating her. He was dating Drew Barrymore, and it became, you know, like a thing. Like, how the hell could this guy
get
Drew Barrymore?
Yeah.
And so I was in a room full of film geeks, okay, and movie critics who clearly are of the age who have a massive crush on Drew Barrymore. So I'm in a room full of people who are really jealous that this guy is with Drew Barrymore. And at the end of the movie, I don't know if you remember, but there's a post-credit scene with just the two of them, like, kissing and stuff and, like, looking at the camera. And it goes, and I'm telling you, everybody in that room was so, all the guys, all the male film critics in that room were so mad. First of all, they sat through the whole movie, and then at the end, it's him with Drew Barrymore kissing and pointing at the camera. Like, here, we're going to rub your nose into it. You didn't like this movie? You thought this movie was crap? Well, here's the last image you're going to see. You're going to see me with Drew Barrymore kissing her. There you go. And I was thrilled. So, and I'll never forget this. We went. So the screening room is on the 16th floor of this building downtown, on Lake Street. And so Roger Ebert gets on the elevator with me. It's me and Roger Ebert, and I think one other person, two other people maybe. And he heard me laughing throughout the movie. And he goes, "Let me ask you a question. Did you like that movie?" And I was like, "Yeah, I thought it was great." He's like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, I thought it was great." And he would just like shook his head like, "Oh my God," you know, and then he mentioned me in his review as a colleague actually laughed at this movie and was shocked.
Oh man.
But yeah. And then I did this thing called Cinema Slapdown that Columbia College, does, where, you take the pro con, and you, somebody takes the con of a movie and the pro of a movie. What you do is you actually watch the movie. You see, you watch the movie. They screen it. Everybody in the theater screens it. Mostly, it's mostly film students from Columbia who are there. And then afterwards, someone takes the pro side, someone takes the con side, and then you debate. You have the cinema slapdown. And so, you know, Ron Falzone is the guy who runs. He's the host of Cinema Slapdown, and he called me up and he was like, "Listen, you're the only person on the planet that likes Freddy Got Fingered. So, would you like to, you know, would you like to participate in Cinema Slapdown?" I'm like, "Hell yeah!" Because it's not it's very difficult to find somebody who likes that movie. So when Ron found out that I actually really love Freddy Got Fingered, he was like, "Well, clearly, yeah. You know, we won't have a hard time finding someone on the con side." But we thought it would be impossible to find somebody on the pro side. So they did, and then they teamed me against five guys from IO. So Improv Olympic, five Improv Olympic IO guys. Who didn't bother to watch the movie. Like, when they screened it, they were like, "Yeah, no, we're not." They went out to eat. And then when they came back, you know, we came back and I killed them. I demolished these guys. By the end of the debate, I had wiped the floor with these guys. You know, who no prep, they had nothing, prepared. They just thought, "Oh, it's going to be so easy." You know? Well, here's the thing, though. I also had the film students on my side too.
Really?
Oh yeah.
They were all pro Freddy Got Fingered.
80% of the crowd liked it. 80% of the crowd, they were pro, and they were coming to my defense and all that stuff. And I also had I will say this. I had a couple of aces up my sleeve.
Okay.
I was going to ask Tom to record something. He said that was a rough part of his life. You know, like, he really took it on the chin when that movie came out. It's not something it's easy for him to talk about. He'd rather not relive it, you know?
No doubt.
So, and I was like, okay, that's cool. But he did send me an email. So I had an email directly from Tom Green. And in the middle of the debate, suddenly on screen, at my cue, boom, a video of Stephen Tobolowsky came on that he did specifically for me, because he was in the movie and got cut out. So Stephen Tobolowsky was in Freddy Got Fingered, and he got cut out. And so, right in the middle of the debate, suddenly Stephen Tobolowsky pops up on screen and says, "It's my good friend Nick DiGilio." You know, he talks about what making the movie and how great it was and how Tom Green is a visionary and all this other stuff. And then he made fun of Improv Olympic. And the house went nuts. Everybody was applauding. And at that time, they were done. These guys from IO were done. Because I had Tobo, man.
Well, when you start dunking on IO, yeah. I mean, then it's over.
He goes,
you
yeah.
Got Stephen Tobolowsky.
He's Stephen Tobolowsky. Oh yeah, yeah, no. Stephen Tobolowsky's like, he said, look at my friend Nick DiGilio. Look how smart he is. Look at him. Now I want you to look at these guys from IO. We just take a look at these guys. You know, I've shared space with IO. They leave beer cans everywhere, and then, you know, and it was hilarious, and it was like a you know, I think it's on YouTube. I think that okay. I think Tobo's. I think it's. I think we put it on up on YouTube. It was a long time ago. It was like 2010.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost 10 years ago. I don't know but it was up on YouTube.
We'll do some internet research here. See if we can find that.
I think it might be still up there, so you can watch what you know. And it was just really. I mean, you know, my argument for you know liking the movie was actually well thought out. You know what I mean? I wrote. You know, we were all supposed to write an opening statement. I can't remember how many minutes we had to fill, but I went over. Like, my time ran out while I was still talking, and they didn't even fill the time that they had. But yeah, it was pretty great.
I mean, you got to stand up for what you believe in.
Yeah.
And honestly, I mean, it's because of people who were willing to go against the grain that I even watched the movie in the first place, because obviously the movie was panned.
Oh, God.
And I wasn't even, like, watching movies like that at that time. I was too young. But then when it comes around to, I started discovering Tom Green. I think I first saw him in Stealing Harvard.
Stealing Harvard with him
and Jason Lee. And I thought he was great. I thought he was really weird and really funny. And when I get to Freddy Got Fingered, they were like, "Nah, don't watch it. It's not worth it." So it's because of people like you who did the Lord's work.
Well, I'll tell you something, man. I you know, Rip Torn, please.
Oh yeah,
he goes 100% in on that, man. I just,
I love the effort.
Oh my God. I mean, the rip torn in that movie is just ridiculous. And then, of course, you know, Daddy, would you like some sausage? It's one of the greatest things ever. So, all right. Well, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got reportedly the worst behaved Saturday Night Live hosts and musical guests. There's some great behind-the-scenes stories about some of these musical guests and hosts who were just horrible. And we'll get into that as well. If you want to jump in with any Saturday Night Live comments, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. All right. We got some weather here, and here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, mostly sunny skies, mild temperatures in the afternoon with highs topping out in the lower 70s. A brief few showers during the evening, mainly north, partly cloudy after midnight. Brisk winds tomorrow out of the north keep the readings in the 40s or around 50 degrees at the lakefront. Inland temperatures will close out at around 60. For Wednesday, high temperatures in the 40s north and 50s south. Clouds and showers likely overnight. For Thursday, cloudy with showers and a few embedded thunderstorms that are possible, and highs in the 50s. And then on Friday, mostly cloudy. Rather damp, cool, highs in the mid to upper 40s north and 50s in the south. It is currently 56 degrees at O'Hare. It's 57 at Midway and 57 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, some of the worst behaved Saturday Night Live guests, musical guests and hosts. All coming up. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200 for talk and text. All right. Yeah, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We're here until 5 a.m. Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And also coming up is Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on WGN. So we were talking about SNL hosts that were bad, and now we've got some stories about SNL, again, with some of the worst-behaved Saturday Night Live hosts and musical guests. So Bill Hader and Jay Farrow said that Justin Bieber's SNL appearance was rough. That's when he hosted. Bieber performed in April of 2010 and then returned in February 2013 as the host and musical guest. While appearing on Bravo's What Happened, Watch What Happens Live, Bill Hader and Jay Farrow were asked who was the worst-behaved musical guest or host that they encountered from their time on the show. Both comedians agreed completely that Bieber was the worst. Bieber, he was just in a bad place, Hader said. Maybe he's in a better place, but then it was rough. Hader added that most of the guests are well-behaved, but Bieber just seemed exhausted at the end of a rope. Bieber made his first SNL appearance in 2010 as a musical guest, and then was both musical guest and host in 2013. It's also not the first time that Hader has called out Bieber for his SNL behavior. In 2012, Hader said that he really didn't enjoy having Justin Bieber around. In a 2013 interview, Hader added that Bieber had an entourage of like 20 guys, which was an inconvenience for the cast and the crew. He had a guy holding a slice of pizza, a guy holding a Diet Coke, and you're going around the stage and you're trying to fight through all of these people just to get dressed. And, you know, you got to, you know, how hectic that is. You know, it's live, and in between scenes, you got to change wigs and costumes and all that stuff, and to have some idiots walking around, you know, as an entourage during the show. Not cool.
I mean, I wouldn't mind a Diet Coke guy.
Yeah.
If I could afford a Diet Coke guy, I'd like a Diet Coke guy.
Okay. But not during the you know,
SNL. Probably not.
Kanye West. There's a surprise. Kanye West was not a dream to work with. Kanye West was reportedly yelling at SNL staff. West made his SNL debut in 2005 when Hader and Farrow appeared on what we hear live again. Farrow also pointed out that Kanye West's behavior was far from perfect. According to Farrow, he said that West tugged someone and pulled them back in place. I saw Kanye yank somebody, Farrow said, and it was pretty hilarious. West performed on SNL in 2016 and also made headlines when Page Six released audio of the rapper yelling at a crew member prior to the live show. According to Page Six, West was upset that the SNL staff dissembled part of his performance stage because it interfered with the lighting. He also reportedly threatened to leave the stage live during the taping, though he didn't actually do that. I do remember. I totally remember that. Did you ever hear the audio?
Yeah, it was something else. And I just feel bad because I do like the guy's music. Can't really account for that, but
yeah.
Personality, not exactly a firecracker.
Yeah. Tina Fey thought Paris Hilton couldn't take a joke. We mentioned her already as one of the worst hosts. Hilton hosted in 2005, based on an interview with former cast member and head writer Tina Fey. Hilton's appearance didn't go smoothly. She's a piece of blank, Fey told Howard Stern.
A what?
A piece of... the people at SNL were like, maybe she'll be fun, maybe she won't take herself so seriously. But she takes herself so seriously. Fey went on to call Hilton unbelievably dumb and so proud of how dumb she is. She also added that Hilton was awful to work with. In a later interview with Playboy magazine, Fey said that she regretted sinking down to that level of discourse. Even though she wasn't entirely proud of what she said, she stood by her opinion on Hilton, calling her a terrible role model for terrible young women and who needs to be ignored.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah. That's Tina Fey, man.
I do appreciate her.
I love Tina Fey. How about this? Tina Fey also said that Paula Abdul's appearance was awful and disastrous. Abdul didn't host or perform. She had a cameo in May of 2005. Fey also called out Abdul in 2005 after the former American Idol judge made a guest appearance on SNL. Speaking to Playboy magazine, Fey said that Abdul was awful and disastrous and explained that Amy Poehler had to play Abdul during an American Idol skit because the singer was being so difficult to work with and wanted to change parts.
Imagine that.
She wanted to change parts. Fey also said that when they later ran into each other on the same flight, Fey noticed that Abdul shared mutual feelings about her, her time as host. I saw it register on her face that she had a terrible time with us. I do remember the appearance, and it was like a lot of Paula Abdul's appearances. It seemed a little weird because there was that period of time when she just she seemed drunk like all the time while she was like being a a judge on American Idol, and then there was there's this sort of this infamous morning show satellite interview that she did where she appeared to be hammered. I think she went through kind of a rough period. I hope she's okay now, but I think she did go through a little bit of a rough time.
I mean, going from being a very popular pop star
yeah.
to fading into obscurity and suddenly coming back.
Yeah.
You're in the limelight again.
Mm. Yeah, it was a weird time. How about this? Martin Lawrence's opening monologue was inappropriate and the show had to apologize. I know, here's another guy who's been banned.
Martin Lawrence is banned?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. After this, the monologue that he did at the beginning of the show was unbelievable. I mean, it was unbelievable. I mean, it was not approved, not approved by Lauren. And he said some incredibly inappropriate, even for 10:30 at night SNL stuff. It was insanely inappropriate.
I mean, I just for a marker for me, was it more or less inappropriate than Louis C.K.'s monologue?
Well,
that was pretty infamous.
All right, yeah. Well, the Louis C.K. monologue was pretty brutal. But I'm talking about in terms of not content so much as just language.
Oh, were they just bleeping every five?
They can't. It's a live show.
Oh yeah.
In 1994, Martin Lawrence went off script in his opening monologue to say whatever he wanted. His monologue was deemed so inappropriate and raunchy, particularly when Lawrence started discussing female hygiene, that title cards were added to it in syndication. It was a frank and lively presentation that nearly cost us our jobs, one title card read. So they put that up during the syndication part of it. According to Lawrence, he said similar things during dress rehearsal and didn't receive any objections. However, NBC claimed that some of the things he said during the live show were completely unscripted. On Saturday Night Live, it's 11:30 p.m. and things can get a little more risque, Lawrence said during an interview. In my monologue, I made sure to ask if their kids were in bed yet. Maybe I misjudged my material, but the people at the show said, you're the host, you can go out and have a good time, and that's what I did. Following his SNL appearance, Lawrence was banned from the show. So... All right, well, more bad behavior on these guys. Here's this one we already talked about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the Adrian Brody going off with his tasteless Jamaican impersonation.
I can't believe he thought that was a good idea.
Yeah.
That's beyond me.
Yeah. So he was, it's just ridiculous. And he, of course, he got banned, as we talked about earlier. We've got more. Steven Seagal is, again, has made the bad behavior list, but there's some really funny stories about his appearance, of Steven Seagal's unfortunate appearance as a host on SNL back in 1991. It's kind of infamous, actually, this, you know, the stories that that have been told about Seagal. You know, like, he wanted to rewrite stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's known for his comedic chops. You know, he's known for his brilliant comedy and his writing. So.
Haven't you seen Under Siege 2? It's a riot.
Yeah. What was the tagline? Under Siege 2, Dark Territory, was it called? Was
I that, think so. Oh, man.
I just remember Eric Bogosian was the heavy, and it was on a train. That's the instead of a boat, it was on a train. And Eric Bogosian was the... Eric Bogosian was the bad guy.
Yeah, it's Dark Territory.
Dark Territory.
Oh, my God.
You know what's really funny is that 90% of Steven Seagal's movies can be described as Steven Seagal is. He is above the law. He is on deadly ground. He is under siege. You know what I mean? They're all...
He is under siege, too.
He is the Glimmer Man. So, all right. The news is coming up right after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. It's Monday, and that means it's jokey-jokey time, and my dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We've been talking about SNL this morning. We were talking about some of the worst hosts, and now some of the most poorly behaved people that were on the show, either as host or as musical guest. 262 area code sends in a vote for Tom Green. I definitely agree, Nick, that Tom Green is an incredible comedian. I used to watch his talk show when he had celebrities come to his house in the Hollywood Hills, which was really great. And then he was just on Celebrity Big Brother. You saw how sensitive, what a sensitive side he had to him. After he was evicted from the house, I stopped watching the show because I couldn't handle the remaining so-called celebrities. I watch Big Brother. I watch Big Brother every summer. Three nights a week.
It's a lot of fun.
I love Big Brother. I love it. And I think Celebrity Big Brother is great. And he was absolutely the best cast member on the Celebrity Big Brother without question. I'm not just saying that cause I always liked the guy anyway, but he ended up winning. He got booted. So he didn't win. But he did end up winning audience favorite.
Really?
He won $25,000 for
charity?
Yeah. I don't know.
Who knows? For Freddy Got Fingered 2.
But yeah, exactly. To fund the sequel to Freddy Got Fingered, which I'd be the first in line to see. Okay. So, well, we got one person out there who agrees with me on Tom Green. Yeah, no, people really liked him on Celebrity Big Brother. They really did. He was very funny. My mom, you know, doesn't really know who Tom Green is. Doesn't really know. She watches, you know, Big Brother and Celebrity Big Brother. That's something my mom and I have. You know, we talk to each other like the next day. Did you watch Big Brother? Yeah, we went. And we talked about it. And she's like, I like this Tom Green guy. And I'm like, yeah, yeah. All right, let's get back to people who behaved really poorly when they visited Saturday Night Live. And of course, we got Steven Seagal, which is not a real shock. He is jokingly called, quote, the biggest jerk who's ever been on the show. Steven Seagal hosted in April of 1991, and since then, he's been known as one of the most difficult people to work with. In the past, Seagal's co-stars have complained about him, so it's no surprise that SNL's cast and crew weren't pleased. Former cast member Tim Meadows called Seagal the worst host during a 2009 interview on The Tonight Show. And elaborated in the book Live from New York, The Complete Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, which, by the way, is on my coffee table at all times. That book, one of my favorite books ever, and it's been, you know, it's been updated, and they're going to update it again. I love that book. Have you ever read it?
I've gotten excerpts.
Because it's, you know, it's like an oral history.
Yeah.
You know, it's written it's in that
thick.
Regard. It's,
yeah.
And they've got everybody.
Really?
Oh, man. It is a great book. I mean, I'm an SNL freak, and I've read every book about SNL. I mean, that's the Bible. That's the go-to for if you're an SNL fan. Live from New York is the one. Mm-hmm. I'm blanking on the other. Tom Shales, and I'm blanking on the other guy's, the other author's name, but it's Tom Shales and somebody else wrote it. But I've read everything about SNL. You know who wrote a great book about SNL? Jay Mohr. Jay Mohr wrote a fantastic book about SNL.
Wow.
Gasping for Airtime, it's called.
Yeah, because how long was Jay Mohr on the show?
I think he was on for two seasons, maybe?
Not even that long.
No, and he barely got any. You know, I got his Christopher Walken got the most, you know, his Christopher Walken impression got the most. Let's see. The biggest problem with Steven Seagal was that he would complain about jokes that he didn't get. So it was like, you can't explain something to somebody in German if they don't speak German, Meadows said. He just wasn't funny, and he was very critical of the cast and the writing staff. When Nicolas Cage hosted during season 18, Lorne participated in the opening monologue and jokingly called Seagal the biggest jerk that's ever been on the show. When David Spade appeared on Watch What Happens Live in 2015, he named Seagal as one of the most overrated people ever. He was a little tough. He was a little tough. He was actually tough, and he was tough to work with, and it was hard, and he didn't want to play along. So, Elvis Costello went against his record label and performed a politically charged song of his choice. This was in 77. Elvis Costello's SNL appearance didn't go as planned. He was supposed to perform Less Than Zero, but stopped the song a few seconds in and told the band The Attractions to stop playing. "I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to do this song here," Costello said before performing Radio Radio, an unreleased political track that he was told not to play. Costello later revealed that his action was inspired by Jimi Hendrix, and there wasn't tension between him and the SNL team, but with the record label. "I had a brand new song ready to go, and I thought that's the one I should play, and I did play. And because they didn't tell the producers about it, they made it stink." He added, "There was a period of time when I didn't appear on television in America, about 3 years. It was 12 years before Lorne Michaels let me back into the building." Many reports stated that Michaels held up a middle finger as Costello during the performance, but Costello seemed unsure whether or not that was true. "I'm going to say that's true," he said. "Bill Murray told me at the 25th anniversary party, he said, don't let Lorne tell you he was in on the joke. I remember him doing that."
Bill's just like, nah, don't let him off the hook.
Yeah. Okay, this next one is legendary. Bill Murray said he got into a quote-unquote Hollywood fight with Chevy Chase. By the way, any of those books that you read about SNL and whatever you read about SNL, the overriding common theme is that Chevy Chase is a jerk and like a pain in the neck to deal with on every single level. And all you got to do is ask Dan Harmon from Community about that, like his experiences working with him, and that was like his comeback.
Yeah,
you know, he should have been thanking Dan Harmon for casting him, and he was very funny on Community.
He was great.
So Chevy Chase's SNL history has been well documented over the years, and cast members have openly complained about him. Chase was part of the SNL team in the 70s during his time on the show. Several people said he was difficult to work with. He was so viciously affected, such a viciously effective put-down artist, the sort that could find one thing somebody was sensitive about, a pimple on the nose perhaps, and then kid it mercilessly, said Doug Hill, writer. Chase willingly left the show and Bill Murray replaced him as a cast member, but when Chase returned to the show to host during the third season, Murray said that they got into a physical altercation. "It was really a Hollywood fight, a don't touch my face kind of thing," Murray said in a 2015 interview. Murray went on to explain that he and other cast members were angered by Chase because we all felt mad that he had left, and somehow I was being anointed an avenging angel. Despite the rough past, Murray said that they've moved on and are friends now. So here's what really happened here. So Chevy Chase came back, okay, to host, and he was acting like a real horse's butt, being really rude to everybody, acting like he was a movie star, you know, and treating these people who are still on this little SNL show like, you know, secondhand citizens, especially Bill Murray, because Bill Murray replaced him. So there was a tension between them the whole time. And so right before the goodbyes, you know, where everybody's up on stage and they do the, you know, they say the goodbyes and everything. They got into an altercation in the backstage, and they were ready to throw down. They were gonna punch each other. They were actually gonna fight, and it was a push shove kind of a punch kind of a thing. And if you watch the episode, if they ever run the episode again, you have to watch the goodbyes. By the way, if you watch SNL on a regular basis, always watch the goodbyes. Molly Shannon once told me that. Molly Shannon said to me, Nick, always watch the goodbyes at the end because you can see what's happening. And I watch it. I watch the goodbyes every single time, except when NBC cuts them off now, which makes me angry.
What, they cut them off for the news?
No, they cut them off. They just cut them off. They don't show them.
That's dumb.
I know. But anyway, when Molly Shannon tells you to watch something, you listen to that, considering she's like the funniest woman that's ever been on that show. So anyway, during the goodbyes, Chevy Chase is there, and you know how the whole cast is up there and the musical guest is up there, and they all, you know, like, he thanks everybody and whatever. So he's up there doing the goodbyes, and you could see Bill Murray like in the background trying to get to him. Like trying to get to like Chevy Chase.
People holding him back?
Yeah, people holding him back. If you watch, because the whole thing started because of Belushi. Belushi started the whole thing.
What? I don't know what I expected.
Belushi goaded Murray. Said he was, I think he also made some stuff up that Chevy Chase maybe didn't say, but he wanted to get Bill Murray mad. So Belushi was obviously, you know, he loved to get behind the scenes and mess around with people. That was one of his things. But Belushi started the whole thing. And if you watch the goodbyes, like I said, this had just happened. The altercation had just happened before the goodbyes. And so you can see, like, Aykroyd and Belushi are kind of next to Bill Murray, and they're holding him back. But you can see Belushi laughing. Like, he started the whole thing, and he was just loving it. He was
such an instigator.
Yeah, he was laughing. He was just laughing. They're holding Bill Murray back, and just, you could just see Belushi just, like, the delight on his face that he had caused this fight between Bill Murray and Chevy Chase. Oh, man. But, again, not the easiest guy in so many people. I mean, if you read any, like I said, any books about SNL, and that he's always the number one pain in the neck is Chevy Chase. Always. And that's consistent in all of the accounts of SNL. It's consistent that he's the most difficult person to work with. So, all right, let's take a break here for some weather. Here's your forecast from WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, mostly sunny skies, mild temperatures in the afternoon, highs topping out in the low 70s. A few brief showers during the evening, mainly north, and then becoming partly cloudy after midnight. Tomorrow, brisk winds out of the north, keeping readings in the 40s and around 50 degrees at the lakefront. The inland temperatures could tap out close to 60. For Wednesday, high temperatures around 40 in the north and 50s in the south. Clouds and showers are likely overnight. Thursday, cloudy, showers, embedded thunderstorms are possible, highs in the 50s. And then on Friday, mostly cloudy, rather damp and cool with highs in the mid to upper 40s north and the 50s in the south. Currently 56 degrees at O'Hare. It's 57 at Midway and 57 at the lakefront. All right. Let's take a break here. When we come back, we got more guests and musical guests and hosts from SNL that were not very fun to work with, that were kind of a pain in the neck. Home crowd at the UC, check. Eastern Conference rival, check. A chance to knock the Knicks down a peg, you bet. Bulls, Knicks tonight or Tuesday at 7 on WGN-TV. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. How's everybody doing? It is a Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a jokey time. That's coming up. It's also, we're going to talk a little bit about Jackie Chan. Jackie Chan turned 65. So we're going to talk about some of the best movies that you can remember to celebrate his 65th birthday. He's made so many great movies.
Something like he's done over 130 total.
Yeah. Directed a bunch of them.
No, he's amazing.
Yeah, incredible. 65. Okay, so now, though, we are still talking about people who behaved really badly during appearances on SNL. And this next one was so painful. Milton Berle hosted in 1979. He told his own jokes without permission, told other people how to do their jobs. And it was painful to watch. Actor Milton Berle reportedly caused multiple problems prior to and during his SNL performance. According to reports, he chose to disregard the rules by improvising, telling jokes he wanted to do without getting them approved, and telling crew members how to do their jobs and exhibiting completely inappropriate backstage behavior. He was also reportedly, he brought in his own group of family and friends to ensure that he would receive a prestigious standing ovation that he demanded.
Nice.
If you, if that episode ever gets rerun again, it's just, it is so uncomfortable.
Do you know what season would that have been?
79 would have been season 4.
Wow.
It was, oh man, it was bad. And, cause he's just, you know, he's from a, you know, he's obviously from a, he's obviously a lot of me, he's Mr. Television for a while, you know, but it's a different era, like a completely different era and not at all what SNL represented or what it was, especially in 1979. Yeah. How about this? Here's a shocker. The Replacements got drunk during their live taping.
Oh, wow.
That's a shocker.
No.
There was a time when you know, if you went to go, I've seen The Replacements many times. And if there was a time you never knew what you were going to get. It's like, well, they might be bombed. I don't know. You know, you're either going to get a great show. You're either going to get a great show when they're sober, or you're going to get a great show even though they're drunk, or you're going to get a terrible show because they're drunk. That was pretty much, that's it.
Total gamble.
Yeah. The Replacements, and their performance on SNL was insane. It really was. It was completely nuts. The Replacements performed on SNL for the first time in 1986. They were problematic to work with because they were drunk during the live taping, according to a biography about the band. To make matters worse, lead singer Paul Westerberg directed an F-bomb at Bob Stimson before his guitar solo. The censors didn't catch it, and SNL crew members sure did. Following the botched performance, Stinson trashed his hotel room, and Michaels was sent a $1,100 bill from the hotel because of the damages. Needless to say, they weren't invited back to the show. Bob Stinson, Tommy Stinson, these guys, man. Yeah. You just never knew, man. I'm telling you, that's the thing about the Mats. You just never, it was like, okay. And they were such a great live band, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it just depended on what you were going to get. All right, how about this? A member of Cypress Hill lit a joint while performing live on SNL. Should anybody be surprised by that? Somebody from Cypress Hill actually lit a joint?
Well, you got to get insane in the membrane, man.
Hip-hop group Cypress Hill wasn't asked to be back on SNL after DJ Muggs lit a joint during the group's second performance of I Ain't Going Out Like That in October of 1993. In an interview with the Village Voice, Cypress Hill member Sendog said that they were told that they could light a joint in the green room, but not on stage. DJ Muggs chose to disregard those rules in an act of defiance. Muggs felt like he needed to make a statement about his performance. It wasn't just the Saturday Night Live people saying he couldn't smoke up on air. It was everyone, our record label, our management, our friends. He adds, it would have been cool to do Saturday Night Live again. Me personally, I didn't think it was a great thing to do for our first time on SNL. But we paid the price, and now we've moved on. Yeah. All right, here's another thing we can blame Belushi on. Fear's performance incited a riot.
Oh, but that was so good. I know he was tight with Fear, right?
He was the one who got him booked on the show. He was not even on the show anymore.
Yeah.
This was in 81. Belushi left in 79.
Mm-hmm.
In 1981 Halloween episode of SNL, audience members were told to look out for surprises, but no one could have prepared for punk band Fear's wild performance. People threw themselves across the stage, pushed each other, stepped on equipment as the group sang Beef Baloney and New York's All Right If You Like Saxophones. In an interview, lead singer Lee Ving, who's awesome, by the way, said that the audience was filled with 80% that they brought in because he believed that they were the first true punk rock fans. The riot-filled performance was so disastrous that it also led to food being thrown. The stage manager got hit with a pumpkin during our performance, Ving said. It smashed all over him. The band reportedly had to pay back the studio for damages to the stage. He said that it was an honor to be banned from the show. How do they not mention Belushi in this piece here?
I don't know. That's like so important to the story.
First of all, Belushi got them booked. It was his. It was at his insistence that they booked Fear on SNL. Second of all, he led the riot. He led the riot. He was pushing people, knocking stuff over. He was responsible for a lot of the damage that happened in that studio.
Oh.
And you know, you can't report on the Fear performance on SNL and not mention Belushi.
You gotta.
All right, how about this? Sinead O'Connor tore up a photo of Pope John Paul II to make a statement. And I still vividly just remember seeing it and just not believing my eyes. Sinead O'Connor's SNL behavior wasn't exactly terrible, but her 1992 performance was controversial and daring. During the live show, O'Connor sang an a cappella version of Bob Marley's War. At the end of the song, O'Connor tore up a photo of Pope John Paul II and said, "Fight the real enemy." Her performance was used to call out sexual abuse, but it was unexpected because during the dress rehearsal, she held up a different photo. In an interview, Lorne Michaels recalled the night of the performance and said he was nervous and that the people in the room could hear a pin drop. I didn't know it was coming, obviously, because at dress, she had held up a picture of the Balkan orphans, which I thought was really meaningful and what she wanted to do. And then I'm sort of all right with people taking chances and risks and all that. But I think everybody from the beginning had known that we were on the honor system. We went live and there was an understanding of trust that when we went live, we had built into the network so that we could play by the rules, which we have. And there it is. So, yeah, that was really just like an unbelievable piece of live television. Whether or not you agree with the protests or whatever she was doing, if maybe, you know, she went too far or, she, you know, didn't make the point clear enough or anything like that. But, man, just witnessing it. And they've never shown it again.
Really?
They've never, ever shown it again.
That makes sense.
You can barely get stills pictures of it, of her tearing the, you know, that's barely available. But they never showed it again.
You know, I wonder, they have all of SNL on Hulu, or at least most of it, I guess. I wonder if that episode's on there.
Well, if it is, it's on there, it's got the alternate, it's got the dress rehearsal performance.
Oh, man, that kind of stinks, though.
It's
like loss of time.
That's what but they do that a lot. Like if something weird happens during a sketch or something, they'll
go back.
They go back to dress because they tape it. You know, they tape the dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
So they go back to the dress rehearsal version of it. So, yeah. But a lot of crazy stories behind the scenes at SNL, and I mean, you know, there always will be. Mm-hmm. So, Adam Sandler will be hosting, I think, in 2 weeks.
Yeah,
Adam Sandler's the host. It's the first time he's ever hosted, which I'm really surprised by. He's never hosted before.
Well, for being such a well-known alum.
Well, you would think, yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe they've asked him and he refused, and now that he's just working with Netflix now, maybe maybe he said yes.
He's got to get some credibility back.
All right, we're going to take a break for the news, and then we come back. Jackie Chan turned 65 yesterday, correct? It was yesterday?
Yep.
Turned 65, which is hard to believe. We're going to talk about some of his best movies. If you guys want to jump in with your thoughts on how to celebrate Jackie Chan's 65th birthday and what movies to watch, 312-981-7200. Talk and text. Jackie Chan, happy birthday to the big man. All right, 312-981-7200. And the news is up after this.
Everybody was kung fu.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Tom, you ever see the T-shirt that says, "Certainly not everyone was kung fu fighting"?
No, I haven't.
I saw a guy wearing that at a Hawks game. And I busted out laughing. I just laughed out loud. No, certainly not everybody was kung fu fighting. The reason that was being played is because yesterday was Jackie Chan's 65th birthday. 65 years young and still going at it. Aren't they doing another Rush Hour?
Yeah, they're talking about it.
Yeah, they're doing another Rush Hour.
Which I'd be happy for.
Yeah, I'm just not a Chris Tucker guy, man. I mean, Rush Hour's okay. It's the only time I could stomach the guy, but I just...
Not your cup of tea.
No, not at all. Especially in The Fifth Element, which is one of the most annoying performances I've ever seen in my life, was him in that movie. He's 65, and we're going to talk about. You guys have any favorite Jackie Chan movies? 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Before that, I do want to mention my film club is tomorrow night. I will be showing The Man Who Knew Too Much, classic Alfred Hitchcock thriller with Jimmy Stewart, Doris Day. Really terrific movie. It's only $10 to get in, and parking is free. It's at the AMC Rosemont 18. Very rarely get to see this movie on the big screen. Beautiful Technicolor in our lovely premiere theater at the AMC Rosemont 18, formerly Movie Co. Starts at 8 o'clock. I'll introduce the movie. We'll watch The Man Who Knew Too Much, and then we'll talk about it afterwards. I'll give you some behind-the-scenes stories and trivia and all kinds of cool stuff. So it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm really, really excited. It's a terrific Hitchcock movie, one of the quintessential Hitchcock movies, featuring, of course, Jimmy Stewart, who is one of the strongest lead actors in Hitchcock's arsenal. So it's going to be a lot of fun and really, really great. So get your tickets now. Reserve your seats right now at amctheaters.com. amctheaters.com. Reserve your seats now. They'll be waiting for you. Again, it's only $10 to get in. Parking is free. And then get there early and have some dinner right down the street at the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant. We've been doing a partnership with these guys now for a few months. It's a great place. Wonderful restaurant, really terrific food, and if you have like your ticket stub or proof that you're going to see The Man Who Knew Too Much, 15% off all of your food items. 15% discount on all of your food items. So get some dinner at the Murray Brothers Caddyshack restaurant beforehand and then head over to the theater, and you will see a great Alfred Hitchcock movie on the big screen, very rarely seen. So there you go. And again, $10, parking is free. And yeah, so go to AMC Theaters. Right now, go to the seating chart, pick out those seats. They'll be waiting for you tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. So, amctheaters.com. So, check it out. All right. Do you have a favorite Jackie Chan movie, Dan?
Yeah. Police Story.
That's your favorite.
It's my absolute favorite. And it's just an incredible work of stunt and like the mixture of action and comedy that he achieves in Police Story, the first one, is just absolutely incredible.
Yeah. I mean, well, about it is that, you know, he does a lot of his stuff is really, really funny. It's not just, you know, it's not just the serious, you know, like just the fighting aspect of it. There's also a really, really, really good, a good deal of humor in his movies. So that's a, yeah. Yeah, that's one of my favorites too. And
they just got beautifully restored.
Yeah,
they went back and fixed them up real, real good.
Yeah, I've been a fan of his obviously for a really, really long time, and some of his stuff, you know, I think a lot of people maybe weren't really familiar with Jackie Chan until, I mean, in America, he had already been a superstar, you know, elsewhere. But I think this is going to sound weird, but I think Cannonball Run is the movie that really turned him on to some American audiences. But 65 years old, which is just crazy, and he's still doing it too, and he does his own stunts. That's the other thing is, like, you know, the stunts that he tries to top each stunt. The stunt that he does in Police Story is insane.
Yeah, when he jumps down the center of the mall
with all the lights and stuff.
Yeah.
He said when he got down to the bottom of that pole that his hands were full of broken glass. And he's hurt himself. He's, you know, he's broken his neck. He's broken tons of bones and absolutely hurts himself. And again, that's another thing that they show in all of his movies. At the end of his movies, they show the mistakes. They show, like, the bloopers. And these bloopers are not just, like, wacky bloopers. They're, like, he almost died because of these stunts that have gone wrong. So they show that at the end, too, because they want to show just how much hard work that Jackie Chan does. And it's absolutely crazy the kind of stuff that he still does, you know? All right. What happened there? They're still on. Hold on a second.
They're still there.
Okay. That was weird. Sorry, some behind-the-scenes stuff. The screen that I look at to see where the phones are just completely. There we go. Now it's normal. What's going on? Did you do anything?
No, I swear to God.
Okay. Some weirdness happening here in the station. We don't know what's happening. All right. Here's Mike on WGN. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
Yeah, Police Story 1 and 2, I think, are my favorite Jackie Chan movies.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just that he's a great stuntman, but the people who work with him are pretty damn good, too.
Yeah,
you know?
No. It's breathtaking to watch him, man, and all of these guys. And, I've told this story on the air before, but after a screening of Above the Law, speaking of Steven Seagal, after a screening of Above the Law, I was standing in the waiting for the elevator with Dave Kerr, former film critic of the
Reader and Tribune. Yeah,
And so this was like after a screening of Above the Law, and I was like, wow, that was really good. You know, that guy, that Steven Seagal, was pretty cool. And Dave just kind of looked at me and he shook his head.
I'm sure he did.
He looked at me and he shook his head and he goes, "I got two words for you: Hong Kong." And then the next day, he brought me a bunch of movies from Hong Kong, including a couple of John Woo movies that I'd never heard of, including Sam, Sammo Hung stuff and some Jackie Chan. And that was it for me. That was it. I was like, oh, wow. All right. There's night and day, man. Night and day compared to
that. Exactly.
Incredible.
I know. Like you said, the outtakes at the end of those movies are just amazing. I think what Project Condor is the one where he broke his back or something like that.
I've actually had the pleasure of I've met Jackie Chan and
great.
And I got to feel the hole in his head because he fell out of a tree in one movie and he smashed his head on the way down and he broke off a piece of his bone and there's a hole in his head.
God.
And he's like, come here, go ahead, feel the hole in my head. And so I actually felt the hole in Jackie Chan's head. So that was,
man.
Yeah. Oh, man, 65 years old. Good for him, man.
Yes, great.
All right.
Great.
All right.
Take care,
buddy. See you later. There you go.
Yep.
Here's James on WGN. Hey, James.
Hey, Nick. How you doing this morning?
All right. What's up?
My favorite is The Big Crawl. I think that was Jackie Chan's first American crossover movie.
Yeah, it was. The Big Brawl was definitely his first was the first crossover movie. It's a good one too. It's a real good one.
The uncle is just as funny as Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah.
that was like one of my first, first hits with Jackie Chan. Besides,
right,
a lot of people don't know that he was in Enter the Dragon also.
Yes, he was.
A lot of people don't know that.
Yes, he was. He was in Enter the Dragon. Absolutely. Yeah. He's a legend, man. And he's 65 years old, man. 65 years old and he's still making movies. Wow.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. All right, James. Take care, buddy.
All right. Have a good one.
Okay. See ya.
All right.
He's 65 years old. He's still doing crazy stunts. He's still going to be making movies. I'm 53 and I get winded when I get out of bed. So, it's interesting because, I guess the people really kind of went nuts over Rumble in the Bronx when that came out in the mid 90s. That was when people were like, I think that's when people became, American audiences became very aware of him when Rumble in the Bronx came out. So, all right. Well, listen, it's his 65th birthday. If you guys want to jump in, what are your favorite Jackie Chan movies? There are a ton to choose from. What are your favorite Jackie Chan stunts? He's a treasure, Jackie Chan. I love that guy. 65. Happy birthday there, Jackie Chan. All right, more Jackie Chan talk. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. We got to take a break here for some weather, and then my dad's going to call and tell a joke, and we'll wrap the show up with some more Jackie Chan birthday talk. All right, here's your forecast from the WGN Chicago Weather Center. Today, mostly sunny skies, mild temperatures in the afternoon with highs topping out around the lower 70s. A few brief showers during the evening, mainly north, becoming partly cloudy after midnight. Tomorrow, brisk winds out of the north keep readings in the 40s to around 50 degrees at the lakefront. Inland temperatures could close out at the 60-degree mark. For Wednesday, high temperatures in the 40s in the north, 50s in the south, clouds, showers likely overnight. Thursday, cloudy with showers. A few embedded thunderstorms are possible, high in the 50s north and 60s south. And then on Friday, mostly cloudy, rather damp and cool with highs in the mid to upper 40s. North and 50s in the south. It's currently 56 degrees at O'Hare. It's 57 at Midway and 57 at the lakefront. All right, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, my dad's going to be here to tell a joke.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go with your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Yeah. What'd I say?
It's It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Oh, yes! Here we go!
Yeah. That's right. Monday morning, and that means my dad calls in and tells a joke. Yeah. And also coming up, the stories that matter with Bic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Every Monday morning, we start off the morning with a joke. And here's my dad. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Nick.
How are you, man?
Doing good.
How's Ma?
Good.
All right. What do you got?
Got a joke. Harry walks into the bar. Everybody says, "Hi, Harry. Did you put on a great show last night? You left your lights on in the bedroom. We could see everything projecting on the curtains. Sorry, guys. The joke's on you. I wasn't home last night."
All right. All right.
Harry's not too bright, huh, Dad?
No. Not really.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dad. I'll see you.
All right.
Take care.
Yeah,
man. There you go. There's my dad. Oh, man. All right. Well, here we go. There we go.
That was jokey, jokey, jokey time. It was a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad told a joke.
He'll do it again next Monday, too. Hey, did you see this brawl between the Pirates and the Reds? This bench-clearing brawl?
No.
It's pretty crazy.
Is it from yesterday?
Yeah.
Ooh, boy.
Yeah, and Cubs are playing the Pirates today.
Bring it on.
Yeah. So, crazy. All right, we've been talking about Jackie Chan. He's turned 65, which is really hard to believe. There is a classic Drunken Master is one of the best. He made that one. That's that was like in the late 70s that one was made. And it's the style in which he did the drunken fighting style is fantastic to watch. That obviously was a big one. We've mentioned Police Story. Rumble in the Bronx was kind of the big crossover American hit. That's when he started making a lot of American movies, like your Rush Hours and your remember the Tuxedo?
Oh man, I love the Tuxedo.
You got Project A, Project A 2, mm-hmm. and some more. We got some texts coming in. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 815 area code says Shanghai Noon and Shanghai Nights are the best. Jackie and Owen are great in those movies. I like Shanghai Noon. I'm not crazy about Shanghai Nights, mm-hmm. but I like Shanghai Noon.
Very fun.
Yeah. 301 area code says Rumble in the Bronx holds a special place in my memory because it's the first Jackie Chan movie I took my sons to. I think that's true for a lot. Like I said, Rumble in the Bronx was the one, when people started to really see his work, on the American side. So, 312 area code says Jackie Chan in The Foreigner. It's not a typical martial arts movie, but a movie about a father's devotion to his daughter. He was great. I purposely never saw a Jackie Chan movie prior, but the IRA storyline of The Foreigner drew me in. Well, that's not a typical Jackie Chan movie at all, The Foreigner. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't like it. Yeah.
It was an interesting move, though.
Yeah,
on the serious side than he's used to.
Yeah, yeah. Now, get this. He's got, I'm looking at his IMDb page. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 movies that are either currently in production or in pre-production.
Unbelievable.
65 years old. Now, he does the voice for a lot of animated movies, too.
Yeah.
Kung Fu Panda. He's a voice in that. But you've got The Mystery of Dragon Seal. The Journey to China, that's in post-production. Project X Traction, that's in post-production. Beijing is in post-production. Climbers is filming right now. Vanguard is filming right now. Rush Hour 4 in pre-production. Once Upon a Zodiac in pre-production. Oh, that's another voice. That's an animated movie. Oh, God. The Karate Kid 2. They're actually making a Karate Kid 2.
Wait, what? Jaden?
Yeah, would be my guess.
I figured he would have aged out by this point. Maybe they'll do someone else.
That remake of Karate Kid was ridiculous.
I thought Jackie Chan was easily the best part of
it. He's the only good thing in it. well, right now, there's nobody else. He's the only one that's listed.
Yeah, they're going to go the Hillary Swank route. They're going to get someone else.
Yeah. I always forget that Hillary Swank was a...
She's the next Karate Kid.
The next Karate Kid. I totally forgot about that. And then we've got another one called... another movie that's been announced that he's going to do called Shanghai Dawn. And then Five Against the Bullet. Those are just the ones that are in production right now. 65 years old, he's got 11 movies that are ready to go.
Imagine how many bones that guy has broken.
Oh, he's broken every bone in his body. And you were having a conversation. You didn't hear me. I actually touched the hole in his head.
What?
Yeah, I met Jackie Chan. I got to meet him. And he's got a hole in his head from one of the stunts he did. He fell out of a tree and bashed his head. And there's a hole. And he's like, go ahead, feel the hole in my head. And I felt it. And there's a hole in his head. There's a hole in Jackie Chan's head.
He's on the bucket list for me. If I could meet him, that would be really a moment.
He's unbelievably nice. Incredibly, incredibly sweet. You can tell, you know what I mean, when you see him in movies and stuff like that, and just his personality. You know what else we didn't even mention? So not only does he direct a lot of his movies, not only does he and his other actors do their own incredible, unbelievable stunts, he choreographs the fight scenes, but he sings too.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got a very successful music career in Hong Kong, and he does, you know, the theme songs to his movies. You could see that. It's another thing that they show, like, videos of him at the end singing at the end of a lot of his movies. So
he's a Renaissance man.
Oh, yeah.
A Renaissance man.
So, yeah, if you want to go back to the beginning, I would suggest Drunken Master, since that's pretty early in his career,
mm-hmm.
and it really showcases, you know, a lot of what makes Jackie Chan great. And, you know, it's not just, you know, the martial arts that makes him great. He clearly was influenced by the silent comedians of the era. You know, your Buster Keaton and your Harold Lloyd and all those guys, you know. In fact, a lot of the stunts that he has done are homages to the silent film era. You know, like there's a stunt that he did that's a complete homage to Buster Keaton, where the front of a building falls and he's standing there in the window. He just stood and the building falls, right? And he's standing where the window hole is.
Uh-huh.
And that's a complete, you know, tribute to the old silent movies. So the other thing that makes Jackie Chan, you know, so special, besides the incredible physical talent that the guy has, is just like his appreciation of what's funny. I mean, he really pulls off great sight gags as a director and as a performer.
It's a style of visual comedy you don't really get anymore.
No.
It's so rooted, as you said, in that silent tradition.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And it's also, you know, you don't see a lot of people doing that kind of stunt work. You know, like actors are, you know, I mean, the only person that comes close, and this is, and I'm just as a comparison, the only major star that comes close to doing this kind of crazy stuff is Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's nuts. Tom Cruise is nuts.
Yeah. I mean, he jumped out of a plane.
Yeah. That's him in the highest building in the world in Dubai. That's him.
Yeah.
He broke his ankle in that last Mission Impossible movie is unbelievable. It's the best. That's a series of movies that actually get better. Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen very often. That last Mission Impossible, that fallout was unbelievable.
And they used the take.
Yeah.
They used he snapped his
ankle.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Nuts. All right. We got a break. What do we got coming up on the show tomorrow, Tom? Do we have a guest tomorrow?
Yes, we do. We have a comedian coming in. He's a really great guy. He's going to be performing at Zany's in Rosemont.
Okay.
And you may have heard of him because he's been on Castle. He's been on a number of different shows. He was even on ER at one point. It's Lenny Schmidt.
Lenny Schmidt. Okay. All right, well, we'll have Lenny Schmidt, stand-up comedian. He'll be with us. All right, we got a break here because the news is coming up next.